Hey guys, brand new podcast. I want to first start off by saying thank you. Thank you so much to everyone who sent me messages regarding my special. I know that not everyone has Showtime and not all of you got an opportunity to watch it. If you're still interested in watching it, go to my Instagram, and there is a way that Red Band figured out. He signed up for a free trial, and he got to watch it for free. So not to circumnavigate the financial powers that be at Showtime, but if you go to my Instagram, Bert Kreischer, BertKreischer, you will see a screen grab from Brian Redband's his Twitter, and that is a way to watch the special for free. Also, if you have Showtime and you haven't gotten around to it, put it into your DVR. I know that it's playing right now, Wednesday night at 5 p.m. on Showtime. Thursday night is playing at 11:30 p.m. Friday night is playing at 2:30 a.m. Saturday is playing at 12:55 a.m. as well as 9:20 a.m. as well as 7 p.m. That's three showings on Saturday for Bert Kreischer the Machine. Monday, 12:30 p.m. And it'll be airing like this just about every day or every other day for the next 90 days, I think. So do me a favor. Watch it again. Tell your friends about it. Spread the word. I want as many people to see this special as possible. This isn't, you know, a streaming website where anyone can just watch it whenever they want. It's old school, baby. I like to keep it old school. I'm 44. I just turned 44 last week. I like to be, you know what I mean? I like to be a part of the system. I give my email address out. I fucking sign up for the, hey, send me emails. I got a cool podcast coming out next week that is was begotten from Rogan's podcast. Hopefully I will get the video that I was talking about with Jamie Kennedy and Stu Stone from Blowing Up, and I will watch that in the intro, and you can hear me laugh hysterically because I do laugh hysterically next week, but that's next week with Stu Stone, who heard of me on Rogan's podcast and reached out to me and then came down. I think he was in LA for a day and came over to my house, and we did, like, it was great. It's great. Today's podcast is even better. They get better and better. I'm really focusing, and thank you everyone for fucking sharing the word of this podcast, because I know my numbers have gone up by three since I really started focusing on this podcast, and it means a lot. And I can't tell you, and I'm being dead serious, when I was in the Baltimore Comedy Factory and I was in the green room, my Showtime special started airing, and you guys reached out to me and you said the nice things on Twitter and on Instagram and on Facebook and the emails. I know I've given out my email a couple times. It means a lot. It really does. It's not lost on me. I am not some hugely famous comic. I'm a guy that's been on Travel Channel for 7 years and hadn't done a special in 7 years. And it's weird to put out this material that you know works in the clubs, but you give it to someone in their living room, and you just pray people fucking like it. And I'm working on my new hour. If you come out and see me, I will be doing my new hour. And as always, you know I'm a man of the people. If you really, really, really want to hear the machine story, I'll tell it. But if you don't, just don't yell out the machine, and I probably won't tell it. And I'll tell you the Ralph Sampson story or the softball story or the... I got so much new shit. I'm so excited for this next hour. This is it's a good time to be a stand-up, man. And if you haven't, the End of the World podcast is online. I was on Rogan a week ago. You can check that out. Support your boy, all of your boys and your girls. Tampa, December 1st through 3rd. Morty's Comedy Joint, December 8th through 10th, Fort Lauderdale the 15th through 17th, Oxnard the 29th through the 31st for New Year's Eve. I will be in Oxnard, and that is my December. And we're going to come out with a tour poster for this coming tour in 2017. And I'm thinking hopefully we can turn it into a shirt and make a tour shirt, and so we can all just fucking party balls. I'm not changing who the fuck I am. I'm trying desperately to lose weight because we have this bet, me, Tom, and Ari, on if by January 3rd, if Tom and I can get our BMIs out of obesity and into just general overweightness, then Ari's got to take us on a trip. And I already know where I want to go, the Super Bowl in Tampa. And we're all going to stay at my beach house and we're going to have a fucking blast. But Ari's got to pay for the tickets. And if I'm overweight, then if I'm obese, I'll pay for the tickets. And if Tom's obese, which will probably happen. He'll have to pay for the tickets. So yeah, so those are my dates. Today's podcast was recorded in New York City in my hotel room with a guy that I had seen. You know, it's so funny. In this business, you make friends with people sometimes before you become fans of theirs. I think that's the way it should be. I definitely was friends with Ari. I thought he was funny, but I was more friends with him. I wanted to be friends with him. Same with Jay Oakerson and Kurt Metzger and Segura. Segura and I were, trust me, he was not even remotely close to funny when we became friends. That's kind of in part true. But the truth is when you're friends with someone, you know they're funny. They just haven't found it out sometimes. And I had known this guy, and then I saw him live one night in Phoenix. And I'm not fucking around. I don't throw this around lightly. Obviously, I do. I say I'm a nice guy in the world. I want everyone to love me. But trust me when I tell you, this guy's legit on stage. Like, he fucking blew me away. I have known Steve Byrne forever. I've seen him on stage a million times. Steve Byrne is a fantastic comic. And let me tell you something. Steve will admit this too. Today's podcast guest is a fucking murderer. But more importantly than that, he was on Sullivan and Son with Steve. And it's the dream job. You're working with all your buddies. And I was always curious when that show got canceled how that felt. Because I know what it feels like to have a show canceled. I've had all of them canceled. And I was curious how that feels when all your best friends are on the show and you wonder, what's your next move? That's the crazy thing about this business. What's your next move? How do you rebound? And this guy rebounded in such a big fucking way that I was just curious. And man, his story is fascinating. It is literally a story of just self fucking perseverance. I'm telling you, man, and I didn't know any of this shit. I didn't know anything about him. I really didn't, and I'm so glad we did this podcast. And this is the reason I'll continue doing this podcast, because this guy is fucking – he deserves where the fuck he is right now. He's earned it. He's earned – my wife always says he's earned his Monday. That's what my wife's famous saying about. She said it about Amy Schumer when her movie came out big. She's earned her Monday. Just fucking take the day off. Pull the curtains down. Get high. Have a beer. Fucking jack off. Do whatever. Not Amy, but what, you know, if she wants to. It's women's world. Today's guest, without further ado, from Sullivan Son, from Last Comic Standing, from The Daily Show, ladies and gentlemen, Roy Wood Jr.
This is...
I use it loud. I use it to do, like, if I do any production stuff where I shoot it myself, I put on the shotgun mic on this and then aim it at me, and it shoots like it's like I have a mic on. It's this. I love this thing. The circular one that comes with it is fucking phenomenal. I have all the money. It's the best. I love this thing.
It's on my hit list.
Yeah. What was the phone call? Oh, hang on. This is what I'm so curious about. So Sullivan Sons gets canceled. What do you think to yourself?
It gets canceled after being unofficially told that we would get renewed.
That's, really?
Yeah. So Steve Coonan, who was then head of TBS and all of that stuff, we had like our traditional end of the season 3 meal, and you sit down. TBS is an extremely dope hands-on network when it really? Comes to talent. So we have a sit down, and it's kind of one of those wink wink, double clutch the handshake, see you next year type of events. Oh, okay, well, season 4 is coming down the pipe. Steve Coonan leaves.
Oh, dude.
To go, I think it was to the Hawks or...
Hawks?
I'm pretty sure it was the Hawks. Yeah, because that shit's all in Atlanta. And to work with the Atlanta Hawks. And it was a dope position. Like, he couldn't say no to it. So I understand it. So then Michael Wright comes in as the new head of TBS. Michael Wright goes, I don't give a fuck what anybody told y'all. All y'all bitches, get the fuck out my network. If your name ain't Conan O'Brien,
really?
Get the fuck off of my lot. He didn't say it.
Yeah.
But that's, He came in and basically revamped the network. And to his credit, if you look at what everything TBS is doing now versus when Sullivan and Son was on the air, stylistically, it's a different network. They literally came in, new coach, new offense.
What did they put in? What did they put on that was new?
They put on, if you look at the style of shows, is what I'm saying. If you look at a show like Wrecked, which is a single camera show, or The Detour with Jason Jones, styles.
Oh, Samantha Bee.
Exactly.
The Detour is a really great show.
Exactly. That style of stuff wasn't on. When we were on, it was us. It was Men at Work. It was the show with Theo Von and Howie Mandel. It's like the hidden camera, kind of like punk type of show. So that style of comedy they turned away from and just wanted to do something more high concept and more power to them. So I am in Grand Rapids, Michigan, second show at Dr. Grin's at the bar, getting ready to go up and do the second show, and I get the text. I get a call from Peter Billingsley, who's one of the executive producers. Yeah. And Peter B. and Vince Vaughn's in the background. Sorry, Roy, we tried. We love you. Yeah, it's weird when you get a call from your really rich friends.
Yeah.
And you know, like, they going to be all right.
Yeah. How's this going to affect you guys?
Yeah. Hey, man,
you
sorry.
You guys sell a merch?
We got to go. We're on set of another new movie that Vince is doing. It's going to be fucking amazing. How are you? God. Well, I'm drinking at a bar eating sushi in Michigan.
Yeah.
That's probably not a good combination. So I was a little sad, but I was more sad for Steve Byrne, man, because, you know, he created it. That was his baby. And, you know, Steve fought tooth and nail for so many things on that show.
He was so hands-on with everything. Like, he was all-inclusive with the way you guys toured, the way you guys did press, the way you did...
We were the only comedy on television that had a tour. Like, I'll give you Undateable. D'Elia and the boys, they went out.
Yeah.
And they started doing a comedy tour in support of their sitcom. But for what we were doing at the time, I think I was first. But nonetheless, to dedicate 3 to 4 months of your life to taping and then another 3 months on the road with just dudes, just promoting, like just grassroots.
Doing press, doing press, doing the shows, selling out. I mean, I remember I saw you guys in Phoenix and it was a sold out show.
Yeah, you did come out to Stand Up Live. So
that is, by the way, and I have to say this very candidly, not to get off track, that is the first time I ever saw you live, and floored.
Dude, thank you.
Legit floored, and I was like, because the only time I'd ever seen you before, I think, was on Last Comic Standing.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
In a weird way, it doesn't, because I go, he's good, but I mean, like...
2 minutes of TV comedy is not... That's what makes comedy contests, so that's a conversation for another day. Comedy contests are just so... I get why they exist, but it's just so not fair to comedians.
I was sitting down, and I watched you, and I went, and there's a difference. There's a lot of guys that you'll see that you go, oh, that guy's funny. And then there's guys you see that you go... But that guy's funny, and I'm not working hard enough. And I'm like, God damn it, I'm lazy as fuck. And I remember going back to Steve and going, holy shit, how funny is Roy? He's like, I know, right? He's fucking by far the best. Bro. And I was like, but so you get the call at Dr. Grin's?
So I get the call at Dr. Grin's, and I finish my sushi. I finish my Michigan sushi, and I go up and do the show, and I call Byrne, and, you know, just gave him a heartfelt thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah.
For him even thinking about me, because, you know, he mentioned Sullivan and Son to me like five years before the show was created. He had mentioned it to me in passing.
Yeah.
Hey, man, I'm doing this show. Shut the fuck up. Everybody's doing a show. Get the fuck out of my face, Asian. Yeah. Whatever. And then sure enough, I get an audition and I walk in a room and there's Steve Byrne. So, you know, I do the show, and this was my first time being cast on something that went to air. So it was my first cancellation. So
those are the toughest. I've been canceled a lot.
Dude, and I bet it's even harder for you because you're the creator and star. Like, I'm ninth on the call sheet. Like,
I've been canceled so many fucking times that I literally had to give a speech to someone in my hotel room one time. And I was like, listen, all shows get canceled. That's part of the gig. You got to be cool with it. It's like, it's almost like the way people look at death. I was like, listen, you know what? I said, what's your favorite show right now? And they're like,
Walking Dead or Breaking Bad whatever.
I said one day that will be canceled as well. I go, Friends was canceled, Seinfeld was canceled. They're all get canceled. Everything gets canceled. You got to be cool with it, and you got to be ready with the rebirth and what you do next. And that's the hardest part of this business is mourning. Mm-hmm. Mourning the loss of something that you love dearly, because that's the other thing. You know, it's these jobs aren't just like they're dreams. It's like a dream. Your dream came true. You were on a fucking sitcom. Your dream came true. Probably. And then your dream died. And all your best friends were there. It was a family. You did it 4 years. It was like a family. You'd show up and everyone would be like, "What's up, bro?" You knew everyone. The fucking costume, legit. The makeup, yeah. Fucking, you had like an assistant walk around and, "Hey, Roy, if you need a coffee, let me know. I'll go run and get it for you." No, I'm good.
Second EPs that are directing their own sitcoms now. And it's like watching your kids go from middle school to college and stuff.
Yeah. And you're doing it with you, Owen, Steve, Ahmed, fucking, it's like the Four Horsemen.
Yeah, it was good times, man. And then,
and then one day, and this happens to all of us, and this is why I like your doctor grins and they go, "Hey, your dream's over, but keep going for your dream." But just it's not
exactly. So now you walk on stage and like near the end of the set, I would do this thing at the end of my set where, "Hey, you know, thank you for watching Sullivan," and I would make a joke about the beer that we drank on set. Some of us drank apple juice that had beer foam on the top. I drank ginger ale with beer foam, and some people drank actual beer.
Yeah.
So it's a whole bit about beer. And as I'm starting the joke, I'm going, "Oh shit, we're canceled. I need a new way to get into this joke."
Oh, fuck.
And I start mentioning Sullivan Son, and people are clapping. "Yeah, Sullivan Son." I'm like, do I tell him?
That's the hardest.
Do I tell him right now? It's like, yeah, I told him. And it wasn't funny, but it was real. It was a real heartfelt moment. I felt like I couldn't run away from that. But I've been fired from radio twice, so I've had a taste of that professional level rejection. It's not quite like Hollywood rejection, but I made peace with the fact, dude, a long time ago, that entertainment as a whole, like, the only thing you can hope for is to just work the road long enough, because whatever your life cycle is on the coast, be it LA or New York, eventually you get put out to pasture around 50, unless you're creating some unique projects for yourself or you're spearheading stuff for younger guys. You just hope to have a following by then of people who still care enough to come see you and maybe bring their kids to come see you so you can quit the road on your own terms and just work casually when you want.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, Bert, we're all black and white headshots on the wall. And 20 years from now, my headshot's going to be on the wall and some new comic's going to see it hanging over the bathroom at Zany's in Nashville and go, "Who the fuck was that guy?
Yeah.
And why does he have an AOL email address on his headshot?"
I've done that. I've gone through those headshots at Zany's so often.
How many do you know? How many? Like, I'd say maybe a third of those guys I literally do not know, have never recognized. If I Google them, I can't even find a clip. And I've tried Googling some of them.
I've tried.
And there's no footage of them online. It's just they're ghosts now. We're all living ghosts.
God, that is a great fucking podcast if Zany's is listening. Just every week it's a new headshot that you go, "Where are you now?"
Because
if I'll sit with the Dorfmans and I'll go, Tell me that guy.
They know their shit.
They know them. They know them all. They're like, "Oh, I remember him." You know who's really fun is, do you ever do Richmond? He's not managing Richmond anymore. I think
Miller. Was it what, Richmond Funny Bone?
Richmond Funny Bone. Is it Jason? My fucking bro.
Oh, wait. Yeah, Jason. Yes.
He is fun to go to lunch with because he's been on the road forever before he started managing. Mm-hmm. And he'll tell you old comics jokes. And dude's the funniest bits ever. And these guys are tired.
You know, I found out a lot of those guys sold their acts to other headliners. I won't name names because it's probably rude and all in confidence or some shit. But I found out but there's some guys from like the 80s and 90s that would just find old road hogs who were just never going to be in Hollywood. Just go, "Hey, man, here's 30,000. Give me that hour of material." And you're a road guy. Fuck it. May as well. I can write another hour at some point.
Yeah.
And they've sold their entire hours to other comedians who went on to do amazing things with the material.
I think that I have a real, and it's probably misdirected, but I have a real integrity issue about what I say on stage or my words, because I go, there's no reason for me to do it. I'm not a cover band. Like, there's no reason for me to do it if someone else is writing it. This is what I can do. It's like ice skating.
I know some guys are good in that regard. I mean, you know, Pryor had writers. But that
blows me away.
But did he have writers, or was Mooney doing punch up and just tightening up a couple things? Because for me, I look at my act and it's got to be my words, my opinions, my perspective. You know, of course, there's comics that are going to throw me a tag or two and try and punch something up. But I've never sat physically with a guy and tried to write out. Like, I was paranoid. When I just did my hour for Comedy Central.
Yeah.
I was paranoid about sitting down with other guys and just getting punch up for my own act, because I wasn't sure if I would have to give them credit for helping me write the material. And that sounds selfish in a way, but I was like, nah, this is all mine.
Yeah,
and just, I'll live and die on it. I can't.
It's the thing. Like I was with, I had this, my new favorite bit is this story about Ralph Sampson. And I wanted to say, it's the first time the point I was trying to make is it was the first time I met black people, meaning I knew a black person before, but I'd never seen like black people interact.
Group,
yeah. And so I said to Shane Torres, I said, hey, what do you think about this idea? And he was like, I do not like it. And I go, why? He goes, it's a little racist. And he goes, you're saying that when they get in groups, they behave differently. I said, well, wait, everyone does.
It's a true statement.
I said, white people do too. And he goes, okay, then open with that. He's like, you got to say white people first. I go, I don't want to. I go, I feel like that's cheating. And he goes, no. Trust me. And so I trust equity.
You got to have the trust, yeah.
And so I went, fuck him. So I went, I met black person before, but never met black people. And everyone was like, what the fuck is he saying? And then I went, well, you know how white people, when we get together, we're like, oh, get the sampler platter. It's 5 o'clock somewhere. And I made fun of white people and everyone laughed. And then I was like, oh, shit. And then I looked at Shane in the back. I was like, you were right. And that, but in that essence, I don't think he wrote that joke. He just helped me.
No, he gave you the guidance. Hell yeah.
So I want to know about the period, because one of the other cool things about this business is the period from like Sullivan Sun getting canceled to then all of a sudden, possibly what I would say is the job in comedy of a lifetime.
So Sullivan Sun gets canceled and we still here's the best part. Bitch, we got canceled and we still had tour dates to do.
Are you serious?
We got canceled. Oh. And we still have fucking tour dates to finish up. Oh. We had like 2 weeks of tour dates left. We had an off week and I went to Grand Rapids. So I make the focus. Earlier that year, I'd started doing Sports Nation on ESPN. Yeah. So at the time, Max Kellerman and Marcus Wiley or whatever, they were letting me come on and crack jokes about sports. I love sports and comedy. I still believe, and I stand beside this to this day, whoever figures out that Rubik's Cube, that guy's rich forever. Like, whatever that sports daily show is, but you have to navigate around the potholes of the league, the players, the sponsors. There's so much more bullshit that you have to deal with when you're trying to make fun of sports, and the legality of getting the clips. It's only so many jokes you can make off of pictures. You need video, and most leagues won't give you video.
Part, huh?
That's why sports and comedy is so hard.
Matt Iceman did a show like that, but I guess
I remember on Versus Network. Yeah.
And they didn't have the clips. It's just
hard.
Pictures.
It's hard. And he was doing Sports Soup, I think it was. And he did it like twice a week. And I watched it. I was like, it's almost there.
I tested for it. And Matt was just the best. He's the best.
He's lively.
He's so fucking great.
He's fucking alive.
He's been working every day since that day.
I'm too angry at the world to be. I don't have that smile. So I go back to what I know, man. I go back to the road. So, you know, thankfully, Sullivan & Son and the tour over those 3 years gave me enough equity with new rooms I hadn't worked before. So I had about 30 or 40 dates on the books going into that following year. But in the meantime, to me, the next move was to start doing more stuff with ESPN. So I wanted to be the guy that married sports and comedy. So I was doing what I was doing with Sports Nation, and I started working with USA Today Sports. And there's a great guy over there that was letting me do a lot of video stuff with USA Today Sports. And so I started doing my own video blogs, just ranting about football and fantasy football. I just sat down one day after the cancellation. I just identified what's important to me. What do I like doing, and how can I make that funny? Well, I'm probably 80 to 90% a sports guy.
Yeah.
And that's something that if you connect with the people properly, you can get dude bros to come out, and you can get their girlfriends to come out and stuff like that. You know, I'm not a ladies comic. Like, I don't have that D'Elia, Bill Bellamy type.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, no, I know exactly what you
mean. I'm not handsome. I don't have that charm.
I've talked about it a lot, and I always say it, and I hope it never comes out like I'm shitting on D'Elia, but like, I don't know where to get the pants he wears. Like, I literally go, what are those Yeezys you're wearing? Like,
where do Yeezy you
find
pants?
How do you find your clothes? I saw him with a shirt that was like ripped and like off his shoulder or something, and I was like, was he painting something? Or is this like the look? Like, fuck, I'm so lost. I'm wearing dad jeans and fucking Nike SBs because they're comfortable and I have plantar fasciitis.
Yeah, I recognize my style of comedy doesn't connect like those two guys. So I know I'm the hangout, grab a drink, let's do a shot type of comic. So shot guys love talking about sports. So let me focus on that. So I'm going to go hard at every sports outlet. So I started doing call-ins on three national shows. I was doing Sports Nation once a month. I was doing my own video blog. I parlayed that into the USA Today stuff. And then lo and behold, ESPN at the time, I don't think they ever followed through with it, but they came a knocking and they go, hey, we're thinking about trying to, and basically they were trying to do their own like Frank Caliendo type situation with Sunday Countdown. This is when Frank had just started at ESPN at this point. And I know they were still doing stuff with him, and I know they had Rob Riggle over at Fox. So I think ESPN wanted to, how can we put more comedy into what we do? So God bless them, man. They gave me free reign to just pitch whatever the fuck I wanted to pitch, whatever I thought would make sense as a segment, as a show, as anything. And I probably had 10 to 14 things in a packet. I shot three of them for proof of concept and sent them in. And I was in the process of, you know, going back and forth with the network, and I get a call from my manager that, hey, the Daily Show is probably looking for new correspondents. We sent them some of your stuff from Sports Nation and some of your stand-up sets, and they kind of like what you're doing. You'd want to go to New York for an audition? I was like, fuck yeah. And the thing about it was kind of intimidating because politics really isn't my wheelhouse. Like,
yeah,
I like it. I can talk about it. I follow the news enough to know, but I ain't Dennis Miller with this shit. I'm not Al Franken. I'm not bathing in it. You know what I mean? So I wasn't sure. I'm like, am I even right for this? But it turns out they just wanted people that could bring the material to life. And if you have opinions about the world, it doesn't have to just be strictly politics. And so when I got there and found out Trevor Noah is kind of running a different offense from what Jon Stewart implemented when he was on the show, I felt a little more at ease about, okay, well, maybe I can fit in here. As long as I have opinions about stuff,
yeah,
there's always going to be issues. The opinions don't always have to be about people or policy, which for me isn't necessarily my wheelhouse. Like when I look at fellow correspondent Hassan Minhaj, Hassan did Correspondence Dinner, not the one Larry Wilmore did, but another one. And he went up in front of a room of congressmen and representatives and roasted, that demolished these motherfuckers.
Really?
And it went viral. Like, Google that shit, bro. He told them to their face they ain't shit. And it was hilarious and it was awkward, and I could never do that.
Yeah.
I could never in a million years, for what my comedy is, I don't have that muscle either. I can't do that.
It comes off weird when I do it. Like, when I do it, it comes off like, oh, wait, he really doesn't like us.
Yeah, and for me, I have to always remember to smile when saying horrible stuff because in my head, you're a black man. Don't scare him. You're a black man. And if someone's scared of you, then smile. So it's too much shit going on in my head. So I did the audition and booked the damn show, man. like, and just couldn't believe it could have given two fucks when I walked out the room, because you have to treat it like that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll go crazy, because every audition is a chance to change your life. And this could be, and mind you, I'd already auditioned for The Daily Show back in 07 and didn't get, I ate a dick in the audition. So I was like, I'm not right for this show. Why are they calling me back?
Yeah.
All right, fine. I'll go. But I'm going to do exactly what I do. And thankfully, without knowing it, the time on Sports Nation and doing the videos with USA Today, it was basically like minor leagues. It was training. It was training for that Daily Show style of desk humor, where sensitive subject, find the joke, tell the joke fast. We only got 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Like that type of learning, that sit down panel style comedy, which is totally different from stand up and it's totally different from conversation. Like learning that, I really think it helped me going into the audition 100%. I don't think I could have done it just coming straight off the road.
What was the audition like? Did they put you on a desk?
Yeah, you basically shoot a mock version of the show, cameras and all.
Oh, really?
Teleprompter, the whole WAP. You do two segments. You do one segment.
And do they like give you the material ahead of time?
Yeah, one segment they wrote, one segment you wrote. And
really?
You perform them both. And
what were your segments about? Do you remember?
I can't remember what the segment what they did was about. Well, I can't remember the segment that they wrote for me. But for me, it was just looking at the script and like, okay, where are the jokes? How do I nail this joke? How do I do the punchline? Backstory. So in 2007, I auditioned. And as I walk out the room, I left my phone in the room. Now, when I auditioned, I completely just, it sucked. Like, you know when you've had a bad audition. It's quiet in the room.
I did an audition one time where my voice started trailing off. Like I was like, and I'm pretty much done here.
The only thing I can compare it to for the men listening, imagine going up to a table full of women and you're trying to talk to, you're just trying to connect with one, but all five of them don't look at you. They don't acknowledge your presence and you still have to complete the sentence. Now imagine you have 4 pages worth of sentences to read before you can walk away from the table. So it was a horrible audition. I left my phone in the chair, so I have to sit and wait for the person who's auditioning after me to finish so I can go back in and get my phone.
Yeah.
Person who went in after me was Wyatt Cenat. Wyatt demolishes. And I'm sitting there and I'm listening to his audition and I'm hearing everything I didn't do. Oh, vocal inflection. Listen. Active listening. Pause. Oh, that's how you do it. And like, wow. Wyatt walks out to like raucous applause. And then I come back in. Hey, I left my phone.
I left my phone.
Yeah, Wyatt booked the fucking show too. Like, I sat and listened to his Daily Show audition. I listened to Wyatt Cenat get the Daily Show. So fast forward to my audition. And I'm like,
you got your hair all picked up.
Yeah, I had the girl fro. Y'all here to replace the afro guy, right? And I remember it's like, oh, okay, it's about listening. It's about the pauses and inflections, and you hit the jokes. It's different from TV acting in a way. So I did their piece. And then the piece that I wrote for them, it was kind of a hybrid of a bit that I had while kind of tied into current events at the time. At the time, the Confederate flag was all the chatter.
Yeah.
And so my bit was basically defending the Confederate flag and why we should keep the Confederate flag around. And I'm pro Confederate flag, because if you get rid of it, how will black people know who the dangerous white people are? These dangerous white people will now be able to just blend in. Like, no. Keep that flag and let them wear it, because if you get rid of this flag, you already got rid of the hoods and the crosses, so you've already made it extra hard.
That's great.
So it was more of the train of thought and the ideology. So I think the audition for the most part is, can you make our shit funny and can you write funny stuff? And
yeah,
I did enough to prove that, but I walked out the room with the same level of give a fuck as any other audition, because otherwise you get wrapped up in it. My audition ended at 1 o'clock. I was at JFK by 4.
Oh, really?
Gone.
And you're like, fuck, I'm home.
I'm gone. I don't want to be like, New York is such, I didn't even realize till I moved here, man. I've never been here more than 4 days in a row in my career.
I have a hard time here now.
18 years, I haven't been here more than 4 days in a row.
Really?
Until I moved here.
Like, I lived here when I first started, and I come back now, and I'm like, I literally live in a hotel room. I like get it. I clean the fuck out of this room for you because it was destroyed. Like, destroyed.
I am, in hindsight, I moved to LA in 07. I wish I'd have come to New York.
Wait, where did you?
I started in the South, man. I started in 98 in Birmingham, Alabama. So my first 8-9 years of stand-up was just the road.
Are you fucking just serious? You didn't move road. To New York or to L.A. until 07?
Here's what I did. I started coming to L.A. in 05, and I would come every other month. And then eventually I would come to L.A. once a month for like a year and a half to 2 years and pretended to live there and told people, I ain't seen you about, yeah, I was on the road.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was only in L.A. 3 days a month for 2 years just to create this, yeah, I'm here.
Yeah.
Because being from the South, I always felt like there was a stigma if you were a road comic. If people knew that you were just a road guy, they just figured you weren't serious. Agents wouldn't fuck with you. You couldn't get auditions because, oh, he's never going to be. Which was true. I was never there. But
yeah.
I don't need you to think that. Plus, I knew eventually when I move here, I need to have these clubs. I need to be able to be past these clubs. So let's do the work now. So thankfully, I was booking enough colleges to where I could afford to kind of just set aside a couple days every month just to go to L.A. and just hang out at clubs and stuff like that. So
really,
that's probably where the perception of me being in L.A. longer than what it was.
Like, that's crazy. I thought you've been there. I moved to L.A. in 2000, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I just assumed you'd been there with me the whole time.
No, I came 05. 05 was my first time setting foot. Now, I might have done a showcase or two before that, but I mean, that was all paid to be there, like some Star Search or fucking Comics Unleashed with Byron Allen.
I did Comics Unleashed.
Every on Earth did Comics
I gotta be
Unleashed.
Honest with you, it's some of the best footage of me. Like, because it was really, he was brilliant. He really was brilliant at what he was doing. I don't think he knew this, but he was creating YouTube clips. So, Bert, tell me about this. And if you could pull it out.
Everybody
plug it in.
Spoken sound bites. Yeah.
It was sound, he was creating sound bites. It was so uncomfortable to do, but it was like, it was
brilliant.
It's some of the best footage I have of me doing a panel bit.
I mean, for all of the, oh, Byron Allen didn't give comedians enough money and he making all this money off of us, that show. That shit ran so many times. I got recognized more from, like, if I ranked recognition right now, it would go Daily Show, Comics Unleashed. It played more than anything else I've ever been on.
Yeah.
More than Last Comic Standing. I mean, because for whatever Last Comic Standing is, the shit don't come on twice.
Yeah, it came on one time. What season were you on?
This was season four? Seven. I did 4 and 7. 4, I got to the semi. 7, I got third place. 7 was 2010. I think that was 20. It was me. It was the year Felipe Esparza won.
Okay.
So it was me, Felipe.
Who's the top five? Did you guys tour?
Yeah. God damn, that was a fun tour.
I bet.
Me, Felipe Esparza, Mike DiStefano, RIP.
Really?
Mike Kaplan, and Tommy Jonigan.
Are you shitting me?
Dude, we're on a bus for 80 cities.
That would be a fucking great tour.
It was a good time. It was a little, I'll be honest, I can speak freely now. It was a little tense, probably the first couple of weeks, probably the first 2 weeks, because we went on tour immediately after the show ended.
Yeah.
So, you know, the four of us are kind of butthurt because Felipe won, because you're a comic. You want to win. You want the money.
Yeah.
And so Felipe was very low-key, and he kept to himself. And, you know, Mike DiStefano, you know, he was very New York, so he, fuck that fucking Mexican, I'm not fucking hanging with him, I'm going to tell these fucking jokes. 2 weeks in, everybody cool as fuck. Once you get over the fact that you lost, and it's not Felipe, Felipe's not the judge.
Yeah.
Felipe just went up and did the same thing you did, so what are you mad at him for? And so at that point, it was cool. He did the funniest shit ever one time. I think we were in San Diego one night on the road, and Felipe would smoke out a little bit before the show sometimes, and I would get drunk, and I'm sitting side stage. I'm emceeing the tour, and Felipe is supposed to do 25 minutes. He goes up, and he does, like, 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And then you just see him pause on stage. Like, you literally see him just have a brain fart, And he pauses for like 30 seconds and it's awkward as fuck. And then he just starts his act again at the top and does the same 10 minutes again in order. He does the same 10 minutes twice, then does the whole set.
Yeah.
He comes off stage. I go, what the fuck was that? He goes, I forgot where I was in my act. So I just started over to make sure I did everything. And it made perfect sense. Because contractually, if you go short, the venue is all pissed off and they want their money.
Shut the fuck up.
So Felipe was like,
I forgot where I was in my act.
Just to be sure, I'm going to start over from the
what
top.
A fucking great. That would have been, man.
And the audience is just like, they're not laughing. The second time through, they're looking at like they're looking at each other like, is this a is they're expecting some great,
yeah, is this a
brilliant punchline at the end of doing 10 minutes twice? And
yeah,
like, and it wasn't. It was and I was just high. And I forgot.
That is fucking hilarious.
Dude, last comic was fun, man. That was a fun.
Wish I had a good experience with it. I hated it.
I still wouldn't advocate anybody. I'm talking about the tour. The show is stress pot.
I just did what you did in 2000 and in Last Comic Standing 4. Mm-hmm. I just got to the semifinals in season 2 and it fucking I hated it. It made me crazy.
It's TV, it's casting, it's definitely playing to certain demos when you pick particular comics, of course.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you ask me, Kurt Metzger should have been in the top 10 of my season. Fortune Femster should have been in the top 10 of my season. To me, the problem with comedy, and this is where stand-up as a whole has a problem, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Nobody really gives a fuck about new comics. Nobody gives a fuck to take the time to discover new comedians. Because comedy is the one art form, in my opinion. It's the one art form that everybody can partake in. You can get a laugh from a goofy baby, some YouTube kid, some fucking old man, some fucking cat videos. No one gives a fuck where they get a laugh. They just want to laugh. Yeah. So stand-ups get lost in that muck. Like if you want a singer or a dancer, you got to get a professional. You got to go find someone on iTunes. You're not going to just let some random YouTube fuck serenade you and then download his SoundCloud. They have to be proven to be like they have to be bona fide. So if you're a new comedian, most people aren't sitting down to watch a showcase show of three or four new comics just doing jokes. If you do, you got to let Felipe Esparza host it on Comedy Central. It's got to be Stand Up Revolution,
yeah,
or it's got to be Adam Devine's House Party. We gotta put these new comics under an umbrella of something that people already approve of,
yeah,
so that you get it's like vitamin in the dog food. In a way, no disrespect to those guys. I'm not calling them dog food, but you get what I'm saying. Kevin Hart, Heart of the City, same thing. New comics under the umbrella of something that's already proven and understood that people already like.
Yeah, because that's true.
The concept of a half-hour stand-up comedy show is dead. Like 10, 15 years ago, that was the shit. It was a goal to get on Premium Blend. It was a goal to get on any of these shows that showcase new comics doing their thing. But now, if you're a network and you want people to see comedy, because on the network side, comedy is cheap. You don't have to pay us a lot. We work for little. Just give us some Cheetos and some beer, and we're good. We're not divas for the most part. We're not American Idol. It's not a bunch of paying for song rights and contracts and bullshit and outfits. It's just microphone and jokes. So how do we get people to watch? I know. We promise the people that one of these people they're seeing will get their dreams crushed. And that's the concept to me of most reality TV now. I love Chopped. It's my favorite show, but I promise you, I wouldn't fucking watch it if it was just called Motherfuckers Cooking. It's just Motherfuckers Cooking. What are you watching? Motherfuckers Cooking. Well, does one of them get their dreams crushed? Yeah. After this break, somebody gets sent home and they cry.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I'll watch. Your gorgonzola confit was burned, chef. It was seared improperly. You are chopped. Goodbye. And you see a motherfucker cry. So you think you can dance. And the voice. All of these shows are predicated around an element of elimination. I watched Project Runway with my girlfriend. I could give two fucks about fashion. But I know at the end of this episode, somebody's dream is going to get crushed.
Yeah.
I'm all in because I want to see the tears. So you take a show like Last Comic Standing where, I hate to say it, but it helped keep comedy alive on the road because it gave the viewers, in my opinion, this is my opinion of the show, it gave the viewers new people to like because your guy didn't get through. Well, that's fucking bullshit. When he's here, I'm going to pay $12 and two drinks to go see him so yeah. I can tell him how much I loved him. Now the comedy club's alive. So now when I'm 50 years old, when the coast has spit me out, I got somewhere to go perform. Because yeah. you need comedians on TV. Televised comedy is what led to the comedy club boom. Now, eventually, the oversaturation of comedy on TV killed comedy clubs because it was too many places to watch it on TV while I leave the house. But I feel like TV and stand-up have a symbiotic relationship.
So then let's talk about this because right now we're going through another comedy boom. Like we're in the middle of a fucking massive comedy boom.
I agree with that. Indie room boom.
Where's the boiling point? When's it going to start spilling over the side of the pots? And when does it spill over the side of the pots? And you turn it off and you realize, oh shit, we've lost half of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like what's going to, cause like I was talking to someone, they're like, there's going to be like 200 specials next year. Like some 150 or 200 specials next year. Unreal. I couldn't name 150 headliners I'd want to watch. I could name 20 that I'd want to watch.
Yeah.
Like 150?
Yeah.
Now, I guess I understand you got to fill.
Specials ain't specials. Yeah, you got to fill content.
Specials are not specials. Like, my special comes out November 11th at 10 p.m. on Showtime.
Mm-hmm.
But you get so excited at Showtime, and then, like, building up, you're like, oh, Sebastian's got another one that's coming out before me. Stanhope's came out. Rogan's coming out. Like, fucking Kevin Hart's just came out.
I'm halfway through Rogan's. Rogan's got a bit about Scientology that made me quit writing mine.
Man, that's special.
Like you talk about seeing comics that make you want to go home and write. Rogan and Jim Norton, I've thrown away more material watching them. I just, okay, I can't do that topic.
Rogan, I watched the whole special. It was phenomenal. Like, there's a bit where he's talking about, like, talking to his kids, and he's like talking to his kids high, and I was like, get rid of that bit for me. That was done better. I got a Santa Claus bit. Fucking scrap that shit.
I watch Rogan, and Rogan be contemplating deep shit. But I need to do more shrooms and write. I need to do shrooms and get in one of these sensory deprivation coffins, whatever the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah, he inspires. He called me at 1:15 last night, and I was like, there's no way that I can't tell him that I'm in New York and I'm not hitting another club because that's the way he is. He like fucking dude. Up at 6, on the elliptical, fucking protein after that, takes kids to school, fucking kettlebells, jujitsu, then 3-hour podcast, then back home, shoot some bows and arrows, take the girls, have dinner with the girls, put them to bed, in the car, to the store, do every room in the store, and then go home. And back up at 6. He's a beast. He makes me, like, I feel guilty when I fly into, like, I fly in Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
I'll feel guilty that I'm not at the store on Sunday. and he'll give you a text. Where are you? Are you gonna be at the store?
Come down.
And you're like, I can't, man, I don't have that work ethic. Like I I'm lazy.
The fact that you own it, like, yeah. Joe, you got muscles, man. That's not what I do.
Dude, I'm just working on losing weight. I'm working on keeping my hair. That's it.
Dude, it's weird though, because I just feel like with all of these specials that are coming out. As a comic, you have to be saying something very specific. Jokes and hanging out, that's cool. And that'll get you one. That might even get you two. But it ain't going to get you a career. And so when I look at a lot of what's out now, it's like, all right, that's cool. That's, hey, man, 2 for 4, 1 RBI. That's way to go. But can you do that again and again? Because sooner or later, you got to start hitting monster homers. Because the other thing comedians are up against now is the web and YouTubers and Vine and Instagram and this new generation. Like, I'm talking 25 and under, who in 10 years, when they fuck and have a kid and got a job and are looking for regular humor, they may not even think of a comedy club first because their first introduction to comedy isn't a stand-up. Mm. It's people in their phone. Like, I remember doing colleges. I was the first comedian. When you do colleges, more often than not, you are the first stand-up. You're the first live show they have ever seen. So you literally have an opportunity to influence.
I never thought of that.
Their perception of stand-up as a craft from here, henceforth, and forever. Because the next time they think about going to see comedy, they're going to think about the last time they saw comedy. Was it good? That's why I get infuriated when I hear stories of motherfuckers shitting on college shows. It's like, dude, you're literally fucking up future bread. Yeah. I don't even think you think of it on those levels, but you know, like, think about stand up right now, man. If I sent you 100 viral clips, if someone sent you 100 clips, this is hilarious. You gotta watch it. Mm-hmm. How many of them would be a comedian telling a joke in a club?
None. I would say none, because
unless it's a car wreck, fucking somebody rushed the stage, or Hannibal Calls Cosby a Rapist type clip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, Hannibal Calls Cosby a Rapist is the only thing that will be in there.
Exactly. It's the only one. And maybe some Chappelle secret, ooh, I videoed Chappelle and succeeded. Like, that's because he's one of the gods.
But it won't even be that. It'll be the Hartford show where he went off on the crowd.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So comedy is the godfather of stand-up, is the godfather of all that shit, but we ain't part of the new movement, man. We don't go viral. And specials are specials, but you got to be saying something. You got to reinvent the way this shit is visualized, the way it's presented, the way it's sold. If you can't reinvent what you're doing, reinvent how you sell it. So that's why I pay attention to these youngins, man. Like, comics love to shit on YouTubers and, well, what they doing ain't real comedy. That's your opinion. Maybe it's not. We might think it's stupid, but guess what? That fucking 20-year-old sold out a 400-seat comedy club at $20 a ticket at a club he can't even drink in. So, yeah, he went up there and did some bullshit, and it was stocked, and he was shitting in his pants because he can't cover 45 minutes. But he figured out a way to connect with people in a way that makes them want to come out and see him live.
Exactly. And if you did that same path he did,
and
you
then gave a kick-ass live show,
you'd be a fucking star.
Bitch, you'd be in a theater the next year.
There's a kid that I don't know his name. I wish I did. I'd want to give him credit, but he did Chicago the week I was in Chicago, and he sold out, or maybe the week before, but he sold out a noon Saturday show, $100 a ticket. He walked with like $40,000.
And you know the theater didn't think it was going to sell, so they probably gave him a great 80-20 door deal or some shit.
Yeah.
There was another one, I think it's Miranda Sings.
Dude, wait, hold on. Did you do Just for Laughs Northwest a couple years ago?
Mm-hmm.
me and you both did that. I was impressed. I sold like a 400-seat theater, 600-seat, not a lot, but like, I was like, fuck yeah. And I was feeling my oats, and I went up to that room where they had the little reception room where you could drink.
Yeah.
And they were talking about Miranda Sings. I think we partied there together, yeah, maybe. And they were like, Miranda Sings sold out. Not only that, she sold like $40,000 in merch.
Yeah. Dude, comedy clubs would book her. I remember showing up, I think it was the Arlington Improv. And she came and did the Arlington Improv, just like a 6. I had an 8 and 10 o'clock show.
Yeah.
She's got the 6 o'clock show. I get to the club at like 7:45. And it's just soccer moms and their daughters. And I'm like, who the fuck are these people? Why are they in my comedy club? And, oh, shit, she was here. Gotcha. And by the time the 8 o'clock show started, Miranda Sings was still in the lobby selling merch from her 6 o'clock show. Like, that's the type of person you don't insult. You go and you study them.
Dude.
You go and you break down, okay, good content. Deliver it on a regular basis. Comics, that's part of why we fail at the web.
The
regularity of it. All you have to do, motherfucker, is just put this shit online this day and this day at this time.
Every fucking day.
Can't do it. That's why I own podcasts, because I know I can't do it. I had an opportunity, and it's one of the things I still kick myself in the nuts on. I had an opportunity before YouTube became YouTube to do that. I was doing prank phone calls. That was my thing before I moved to LA. I was doing morning radio while I was doing the road.
Yeah, where were you doing morning radio?
I was doing in Birmingham. I graduated in Tallahassee, Florida A&M, and I went back home to Birmingham, and I started doing prank phone calls. So, but what I was doing, I was taking my pranks. I was having trouble breaking in certain rooms in the South and in the Midwest. So I figured out which radio stations the comedy clubs advertise with. And then I figured out which DJ on that clock would be most likely to use my prank phone calls. So if they had a syndicated morning show, I couldn't fuck with the morning show. So I would do afternoon drive. So I would send prank phone calls. I had a nice little presentation packet. And I was like, man, this is 03. I'm mailing tangible CDs with labels. I'm printing myself and color folders. And I'm mailing this shit to radio DJs. And I mail them like a five prank call sampler CD. I go, hey, man, if you like these, I can send you some every week. Just say my name on the radio. That's all I need you to do, man. Just say my name. And
holy fuck, that's
so about 20 stations bit. And so I was on about 20 stations around the Southeast and the Midwest. 20 turned to 40. And at the end of the year, I hit all of those comedy clubs. Now, I've been sending them material every 6 months like you're supposed to. Send a fax. That's how long ago this was. You'd fax your reveals and your headshot.
Yeah.
But now I email these clubs and I go, yo, I'm on in your market. I'm looking to do a show there. I'm looking to do a show in conjunction with the station. Would you mind having me feature? If not, I understand. Maybe I'll catch you the next time I'm in town to do a show. And I step to him from an angle of, the show is happening, motherfucker. So either it's going to happen at your room or it's going to happen somewhere else. And I didn't give two fucks because I wasn't working your room anyway. What are you going to do, ban me?
Yeah.
So, and in those days, comedy clubs were less connected. So you could piss off Wichita and still be able to work Tulsa. You know, yeah, there weren't as many, you know, the loony bins, there were loony bins and funny bones. So if you pissed off one room, sometimes if there were a chain, all of them would ban you. But if I'm not working any of the fucking loony bin clubs, what do I give a fuck?
Yeah.
So I would email these clubs and most of all of them bit. And that's how I started getting work in those markets.
You make me want to work harder. Like I think about that and I go,
I'm the only feature act you can book that has radio that can go do radio. Not even your headliner can get on this fucking station. And you're not going to feature me? I'll do a headlining show across the street just to fucking be an asshole.
Yeah.
But they would feature me. And all I wanted was feature work. I wasn't asking to be headlined.
Damn it. Hold on one sec. That makes that makes sense in a weird way, is that you earned it. That you, like, see, there's so many, all I think about is, like, is me at that time. Like, I think, okay, I'm going to put it this way. I was talking to Kurt Metzger, and we were talking about racism in comedy, and I was trying to explain to him, I don't know if I did this in the podcast or after the podcast, I was kind of drunk, but I was trying to explain to him, to be black and to headline like Funny Bones or improvs as an unknown is next to impossible, unless you're an urban comic and that's what you sell to. If you got a name like slap that ass,
yeah,
then you could do it. But to be,
but you do the Black Knight,
yeah,
you do the Black Knight in the mainstream week. And for me, I ain't never been no urban act. I do black rooms because they would book me. And I started figuring out real fast when I started, you work in the South, man, you only getting up once a week per city. So you got to drive every other day. You got to hump 5 hours to go get 10 minutes of material. So one night it might be a black night. The next night is rednecks. The next night is mainstream. So you need a joke that, well, at least for me, I need a joke that works in all three rooms, because I ain't going to be writing a bunch of different fucking material.
Your act is who you are. It's not, I wouldn't say it's technically, like, I don't know. You're definitely black. Your act is definitely black.
I talk race,
but it's not.
Motherfucker, you ain't put that mayonnaise on the. You gotta put that mayonnaise on the pussy. You ain't put no mayonnaise on the pussy, boy. Like, it's not that. I'm not putting mayonnaise on vaginas.
But it's not like pandering. It's not like black guy going into a white room being like there's a couple black guys that I've worked with in the past where they're like,
the code switch on you and they become a different comic.
Yeah. And it's like, it's all of a sudden they're like, I know what you're thinking, you know, whatever racist thing. And I'm one of the good ones. And you're like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
That is not what I would, but the fact that you hustled these rooms and you got and you did the work in your apartment, sent the work out, then chased down the work.
Not when you're on the South and the Midwest, you have a lot of time not performing, so you have a lot of time to figure out when is the next where, who books what. So the goal every month was perform in a different city. Just every month, find a different city to go tell a joke in. And by the end of the year, you got 12 new places to go fuck with for next year. So just and exponentially, it'll grow. But what I didn't understand that I was doing at the time, and I wish I understood it, is that those rooms booked me because I added a marketing value to their bottom line. I was there's no comedy club that was booking Miranda Sings because they thought she was funny. No disrespect to her or any YouTuber. It was, oh, she has a product. She has a following. We would be stupid not to book her.
That's fucking and interesting. So, you're totally right. No one, it's a bottom line marketing value.
Yeah. And I was doing that with prank calls way back when and just didn't quite understand it. And when YouTube hit, I had a website set up where people could go and download pranks if they missed them. People were taking my prank phone calls and putting them on YouTube. And it was just to me, YouTube was just this thing. Like, what? You put videos? What? That's stupid. Fuck that. Just go to my website. Because remember back in the day, you wanted your website to do hits so you could set up your Google AdSense and make a couple dollars on a Google click ad. And to me, that was money. And that's the downside of being away from L.A. or New York, is that you're not surrounded by enough comics that are in the know and understand the shortcuts and the little what's around the curve, what's next. You're behind, you're constantly behind the fucking curve on stuff, man. And I look back on that time period with a lot of regret, because had I known what I known about YouTube then, I'd be a fucking beast, bro. And I stand beside that statement, because my pranks at that time were like, this is when shit was going viral over email.
Yeah.
Like, you'd send an email attachment and you had to trust whoever sent it to you that it was a good fucking link and all of that shit. So, you know, I look back on that time with a lot of regret, because I ignored tech. I didn't educate myself enough on it. And that's something that would have elevated me to another level. And I had this, I mean, my jokes then were definitely 2004 jokes, but I had enough of a live show and enough of a live show pedigree that if you came strictly for prank calls, you weren't going to leave disappointed that I wasn't funny.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, fast forward to now present day, I study the fuck out of anybody that's doing the internet the right way, because I want to know what I can do to help marry those two things. And that's what I was trying to do with the sports and the comedy. If anything, getting the Daily Show in a weird way got in the way, because it was like, wow, this is a golden opportunity. I can't say no to it. But fuck, I was making traction with the other stuff. But it's like, okay, go here, do it, learn, absorb,
yeah,
grow as a comic. And I've definitely, it's definitely opened my fan base. It's definitely gotten a lot of people.
It's so fucking great.
I wouldn't have an hour special if I didn't book the Daily Show.
Someone said to me the other day, they were, I want to say it was like one of my wife's friends was talking about you at Drop Off. And I said, wait, how do you know him? She's like, are you fucking kidding me? I love The Daily Show. I watch it every single day. And I went, oh, I like totally forgot. And in my head, I was like, oh, fuck yeah. Like, that shit is.
Yeah, it's.
It's a gold standard.
And you know what I love about it now is that Trevor has been able to take what Jon Stewart did and put his own twist to it. You know, he's definitely not Jon Stewart, but thankfully he's not trying to be.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing I can compare it to is in sports. It's like when Aaron Rodgers took over for Brett Favre.
Yeah.
And everybody goes, you're not Brett Favre. You're, oh, wait, you're good too, but you do it different. Like, that's basically the arc of it, is Trevor's coming in with a totally different perspective of American politics and surrounding himself with people with strong opinions as well. And that's been his approach to it. And, you know, I'm definitely nervous. I'm still nervous because it's an institution. It's like fucking wearing Yankee pinstripes or something, bro. Like, I don't want to be the correspondent that fucks it up. Like, I don't want to be, you know, when you look at all of the correspondents that have come before you and done amazing stuff and been able to do well with the show, it's like, huh, all right. So if you do this right for a little while, maybe you can open some doors for yourself. But first and foremost, do the job right. So, I mean, I spent the first month just watching old correspondent footage. They have a vault of B-roll of every single Daily Show interview that has ever been conducted.
Really?
I sat for a month. I watched as much of it as I could. It's so much shit, man. It's a room probably the size of like a one-bedroom apartment. And it's just racks and racks racks of tapes. And I'm watching Steve Carell B-roll. I'm watching the first year of Give Me Colbert. And that's why I told one of the ladies that runs the room, I go, I want to see a tape of Colbert first year, and I want to see a tape of Colbert from his last year. And just the raw interview, like an hour interview. And just I'll watch the piece that it was created from, and then I go back and just watch the 1 hour raw and see just the little things and the little tricks that they're doing. And everybody's strength can't be yours, but in watching it, you identify what all the different tools are. And so you start learning, all right, this guy does these four or five things and they work for him. This guy does these things. So you start learning, all right, what are my four or five things? I think right now maybe I have one, maybe two, maybe. It takes time to learn the job for sure, but I'm having fun doing it. And thankfully, you know, we got a good election to really mine some great material from as well. You know, it would be interesting to see how the Daily Show would have transitioned in a non-election year. And what that would have looked like. And
yeah, that's the crazy thing is you guys got, I mean, this.
It was a gift. It was a gift, really, dude.
It's fucking, I mean, it's so.
Everyone's so charged about this guy that everybody's like, what? Who said what? What did he say? What's the joke? And so like everybody is like, everybody's feet, like Trump is a dead whale in the political ocean and everybody's feasting. Everybody's feasting. This election is just that big carcass that I don't know if you saw The Shallows.
I almost watched it on the plane.
It's not bad. It's a shark movie.
Yeah.
So you know what it is. It's, oh, I'm in the water. Oh, I'm out the water. Oh, I'm in the water. Oh, it almost got me. I'm out the water. That's pretty much the pacing of every shark movie. And then every now and then a motherfucker don't get out the water in time.
Yeah.
So it's like there's a scene like that in The Shallows, but it's basically that. It's a big dead whale, and The Daily Show is feasting. Fallon is feasting. Seth Meyers, Sam B. Everybody's eating, and it's good. It's good times.
Fucking. I can't wait for it to be over personally, because it's like one of those things where it's like, you know, you watch like you just see comics that you like that get real passionate about it and then start like fucking fuck those people, and you're like, they're people too. Like,
yeah, I'll never be that. To me, sports has definitely calmed me.
Yeah,
because honestly, I'm more scared of a sports zealot than a political zealot, because people have done a lot of stupid shit in the name of sports. There's murders and stabbings every year because my team beat your team, or
yeah,
a Dodgers fan beats a Giants fan.
You know that about Dodgers games? They're fucking sketchy.
I waited to leave. We went to Dodgers Cubs last year when Arrieta threw the no hitter.
Yeah.
I stayed in the stadium until it was completely empty. I was like, I don't even want to be in a parking lot.
They're shutting the lights off.
I want everybody gone before I walk to the car, because I might say something, he might say something. But at least with politics, it's a charged environment. Everyone talks shit. And then for the next 3.5 years, people kind of go back to some level of calm and reserved disdain for the establishment. Whereas with sports, it's still, I'll beat your ass on sight because I don't like your shirt.
Yeah, isn't that crazy that grown men get like that? We got Rams games. There are dudes that show up in Raiders gear to the Rams game. and they say, like, hey, how long you been a fucking Rams fan, huh? Hey, are you a Rams fan for real? Hey, how long you been? How long you had that hat, eh? And you're like, fuck. You're like, did you really just come to a Rams?
Dude, I grew up selling sodas at Alabama games.
Shut up.
I grew up selling sodas.
You sold sodas at Alabama games?
I was a stadium vendor at University of Alabama games in high school, and I saw the fights. I saw all the fights. University of Florida. And this is when 92, 93, 94. So this is when Florida was coming in and whooping ass. Like, yeah. Alabama just come off the national championship, and the University of Florida was coming in just beating the shit out of them. And fans would fight in the restroom. They would fight in the concourses. And I was just like, this isn't that deep. Neither of you even go to this college.
That's the crazy part. When you go like Miami or Alabama, there's a lot of Alabama fans that don't even live in Alabama.
Yeah, and I'm like, it's a dude in a shirt catching a ball against another dude in a shirt catching a ball.
Yeah.
To me, that's crazier because at least a political zealot, at least their beliefs and their passion is rooted in, I believe this will change the country.
And this will change my life.
No matter who you agree or disagree with, all parties involved think that they're doing what is best for America. So they think they're coming from a genuine place. It's like a good villain in a way. Whereas a guy who just goes, fuck your team for catching the ball more times than my team, I'm going to beat your ass. Who's more dangerous? To me, it's the guy with just no motivation other than a ball to beat the shit out of you. So, yeah, I learned early on that it ain't that deep with sports. And you'd see drunk fans. The guy almost fell over the top of the stadium. Like, it's – people are crazy.
Oh, so what are your teams?
Cubs, Dolphins. Those are my two diehard.
Really?
Yeah. Like,
how'd you become a Dolphins fan?
Did regional coverage, same way I became a Cubs fan.
Really?
You grew up in the South. It's the only thing on TV.
Dude, all we got were Cubs games. Yeah. We got Cubs games and Braves games.
Problem with the Braves is that the Braves games came on at night, and my daddy wanted to watch Hunter and L.A. Law. So he would, and we were one of those one TV households, so yeah. I couldn't fight my dad for the TV. So if you wanted to watch baseball, you could have a favorite team, but you ain't watching them till they play the Cubs.
Because the Cubs, I don't know if this is accurate or this is how I remember it, the Cubs didn't have lights, so they played all their games during the day.
Correct. They didn't get lights until 88, and then after that, they still had to make a deal with the homeowners around the stadium to only play X number of night games.
Yeah.
So they have a predominant day game home schedule.
Yeah.
So because of that,
that's so crazy. We all got Cubs games in the South.
Yeah. So in the middle of the day, on a hot-ass summer day, it's too hot to go outside, sit inside, watch Ryan Sandberg, and around 4 o'clock, go back outside and keep playing.
It's so crazy that the amount of I always say that I always say from I'm 43 that there was segregation still in the South, and the fact that just everyone kept to the, like, there were just black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods in Florida. That's how I remember it.
But Birmingham was like that.
Yeah, it was integrated, but it was integrated and it was cool, but it was still a weird segregation.
Birmingham was different though, because we had black neighborhoods, and then we had white people in the black neighborhoods who couldn't yet afford to move out of the black neighborhood, so they're mad that they're in a black neighborhood. Yeah. So you had white people who wouldn't talk to you. They still live in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So it was like we moved to Birmingham when I was in the third grade. And
from where?
From Memphis. And so
are you the oldest?
I'm the only. I got a bunch of older half-brothers. My dad fucked a lot. I'm the only kid by my mom.
So yeah.
It's keep it black like that. And so it was in the middle of white flight. So the ghetto was turning blacker. Crack was taking over. And there was just angry white people who just couldn't afford to leave, and they straight up wouldn't make eye contact with you walking down the sidewalk. It was some weird shit, man.
Southern white pride, I guess it is an interesting. My wife grew up right on the border of Alabama and Georgia, mm-hmm. and a real 1,200 people in her town.
Is that Phoenix City or something?
Bowdoin.
Oh yeah.
And it's really interesting. I think it's the same distance between Birmingham and Atlanta. So you could fly out of either.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. It was like the what racism was it was just bizarre. Like, I don't know. I don't know the right way to explain it because I only saw it as an adult from her. But like, she would explain it to me, and it was like, we didn't have that in Florida. Tampa was different. Tampa was just like so separate. But the one thing, this one weird commonality that I just heard you say was that all us kids were all watching Cubs games.
Yeah.
Here we are in Tampa and Alabama. We're both Cubs fans because we're both watching. Because that's the way the programming was. Like, I bet we had the same favorite professional wrestlers. Like,
yeah. I even watched GLOW. I liked Ultimate Warrior. I liked George the Animal Steel.
Oh.
Coco Beware because he was black. I liked him better than Junkyard Dog.
I like Coco Beware. I like Leapin' Lenny Poffo.
Yeah. Dude, I would watch wrestling and then do. I broke my mom's bed frame doing wrestling moves off her dresser onto the bed onto imaginary wrestling opponents. Like just.
I got spanked one time for giving my sister the claw. Kerry Von Erich had the claw. And I just would come in the living room and be like, oh, I can't control it. And I smacked it on her head.
Yeah.
My dad's like, what the fuck's wrong with you?
But yeah, racism like in the South, because Birmingham, I think it's 70% black. It's a predominantly black city.
Yeah.
So I went to predominantly black schools. Sixth grade, I got bussed out to an all-white school. That was a very interesting experience. But I didn't really encounter real legit racism until high school when I played baseball and we would play schools from the county.
Ugh.
That's when you start playing these all white schools and, you know, we prided ourselves at Ramsey because a lot of the city schools in Birmingham didn't take baseball seriously. Like there were times we would play motherfuckers. They was wearing jeans and not even wearing cleats and shit. And
yeah.
I don't know if it was a money issue or they just didn't care. So city schools were seen as inferior in baseball. And statistically, they were. But we were a team. We had our uniform. We had our shit together. We were a good team. And we play. But because we were a city school, we were just seen as inferior. You're a city school. Fuck those niggers. Like, it was nothing to slide into second base and have a guy step on your hand and just mumble nigger under his breath and then just throw it. And the ump doesn't hear it or the ump hears it and doesn't care.
Yeah.
So it's little like it was shit like that. That's when I started like, oh, fuck that. Like you hear about racism, you read about it. They take you to the museums. But to literally be called nigger and then not only be called nigger, but you can't even do shit about it because your team is down 3 runs.
Yeah.
You kind of want to, you don't want to get thrown out of the game.
Yeah.
So you got to take it. So you start figuring out, we figured out little ways to fuck with them. Like we would do, oh my God. And this is where like, I think my comedy started coming from because I rode the bench a lot. And so I started figuring out real fast. You could call us any of those words, but like a teammate, like say somebody got called nigger rounding first base or something.
Yeah.
They would come back to the dugout and report to me and the other bench warmers. Who is it? Number 14? Okay. And we would ride his ass for the next 2 hours. Anytime he came up to bat, anytime he touched the ball, like shit that would like legit get us. It would qualify as bullying or verbal abuse. Now,
oh, yeah.
We would lay into these motherfuckers. And that was probably like the first legit open mic because you could see the parents in the crowd laughing. And we're obliterating this kid's self-esteem. Fuck you and everything you stand for. My God, if Facebook was out,
oh,
then, bitch, I would Facebook about. I hear stories of fans doing that to players now at the pro level. I'm like, it's wrong to harass it. But I get it. Like, I would do my homework on you, and I would eviscerate you, your girlfriend, your pet dog, whoever. So, like, all that joning and playing the dozens and cracking on people.
Yeah.
That was the origin points of it. I probably got to really tip my hat to racism for helping me find my sense of humor. Like, we would slap people in the face. Like, if I played first base, like, if you call my teammate a nigger and you're on first base, I would go over to the mound and I would just call for 5 pickoff throws. At some point in this sequencing, I need 5 pickoff throws. And each time you slid head first back into the bag, I'd slap you as hard as I fucking could in the ear hole of your helmet.
Yeah.
Because of the air displacement. And you literally can make a man dizzy.
Yeah.
If you constantly hit him in the ear hole of the helmet by forcing air into the ear canal. I slap you 4 or 5 times. This motherfucker's woozy. He's damn near standing on the base. He's so scared.
Yeah.
So you start learning ways to deal with it. Because, you know, for all that racism is, I think I'm of that first generation that could kind of retaliate a little bit and kind of say, fuck you, nigga. Well, fuck you, fucking whitey. Like,
yeah.
Without fear of ass whooping or lynching. So there was something, if there's anything, I don't know if that's what Malcolm and Martin were fighting for.
They had that in mind. I have a dream.
Yeah. That we can talk shit back to these motherfuckers.
That's all we're looking for. Just fucking equality and talking shit.
So, I mean, there was racism, but we had opportunities to get our licks in, too. So I never felt that fear. I mean, of course, there's certain rules you abide by. You always have your ID with you. You travel in groups. And when we were going out to county games, the parents wouldn't let us drive alone. If you were a senior, you took – if you were underclassmen, you rode with a senior. Like, there was strength in numbers. So it's just little rules like that that we had to kind of –
ingrained in how they grew up. There was like – I can't imagine what it must have been like to be like your parents' age or my parents' age and be black in the South and know that there is no safety.
There's nothing you can do.
That is.
I saw a black kid walking out of a store with just something in his hand. And I guess I assume his parent paid for it or whatever. But in the back of my head, as a black man, like all kinds of alarms are going off. And I'm thinking, man, you know, I have a 5-month-old now. And I'm thinking about my son and how to not get fucked up by racist rules I'm going to have to teach him. And one of them is you can't leave a store with just shit in your hand. Like, I have a bit about it, but it's the truth. Like, as a black man, the bag, that's like, that's your freedom papers to get out of the store. You need a bag and a receipt at all times just to not give people a reason to bother you and mess with you. You know, I didn't really experience real racism, I don't think. Outside of that, until I got on the road, man, when I started performing and all these redneck rooms and motherfuckers wouldn't shake my hand after the show, or there was always like a table full of fucking hillbillies who wouldn't laugh. And, you know, I had a table kicked out of a show. I was in Asheville, North Carolina. It was a hotel gig, one of those, you know, hell gigs. And it was an 8-top that wouldn't shut the fuck up. And I had them kicked out, and as they're walking out the room, they call me a nigger, and I'm on stage, and I like literally like, you know, and I don't have my baseball teammates. I can't go, hey, give me 5 pickoffs, slap them in the head. It was a surreal moment, man, and you know the room for the most part rallied around me, but then I end up getting banned from the room because as a feature act, you don't have the authority to kick out my paying customers. Are you fucking serious?
Fucking ridiculous. So,
to me, the nigger, the dude who called me nigger isn't the villain. It's the person who banned me from the room. It's like, you co-sign on that? Like, that's why when I look at Trump is a more dangerous racism, like dangerous racist, because he can legislate. You have the ability to change laws. That's real racism.
Yeah.
Somebody yelling nigger out the truck or... you know, God forbid, attacking a black person. That stuff is horrible and it's wrong. But to me, the far greater danger is the person with the pen and paper and the ability to go, you know what? Let's just move all the voting registration days to this day, to these centers. Like in Alabama, they closed a bunch of the voting centers in the poorest counties because they don't want poor people voting because poor people vote Democrat. And Alabama is a red state.
Really?
So, yeah, to get your voting ID card, you have to go to this center that's an hour away. But you're poor, and there's no mass transit, so good luck figuring out how the fuck to get over to the other county to register to vote.
That is institutionalized racism.
Exactly. So that whoever created that policy, give me the motherfucker that's calling me nigger in the back of the comedy club because he can't do shit. He's just angry and yelling. So when you look at somebody like Trump, they go, oh, well, he's a racist. He ain't racist in the sense of let's go fucking build a wall to get these wetbacks. He's just saying that shit to get the fucking truck races on his side. Trump is real legislated.
That's
like
what
fucking bigotry.
Kurt said the most genius thing last night. He's like, I don't think Trump's racist. I think he likes playing the race with the racists. He likes stirring up the racists and going, hey, yeah, you want to fucking co-opt my ideas? Let's do it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, hey, this is a real easy group to manipulate.
Yeah, what can I say to get them on board? Oh, I know. Build a wall. Yeah, build a wall.
Yeah.
You got our vote. It's the same thing with Obama.
Rapists and murderers.
Like, people think everybody loves Obama off of policy. Like, there's plenty of black people that voted for Obama simply because they saw him fucking shoot a jump shot. And it was like, fuck it. He plays basketball. You know, that was like the black people build a wall.
Yeah. His jump shot. Okay,
yeah,
I got it.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just...
He's a good basketball player. like, there's a lot of people that suck at basketball. He looks pretty when he plays basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like, I know for a fact, and then I never thought of it that way, but when I saw him shoot a jump shot, I went, oh, he can play.
He looks like he used to play good back in the day.
Exactly. It's like, oh, like, that's okay, smooth. Cool. I like them now.
But yeah, it's just things like that. When I got on the road, that's when I got really cognizant of racism, because I was doing comedy in a lot of strange places. I was driving way too fast. I got pulled over on a regular. So, you know, you're in, you got out-of-state plates, and I'm a comedian, sir, and I'm young. I was 19, so I'm like fucking 21, really? 22, and these weird-ass Georgia counties, I'm getting pulled out of cars by gunpoint, having my car going through up and down, and your shit strewn across the freeway, and the state trooper just goes, have a nice day, and just drives the fuck off, and now you're on the freeway putting your shit back in your car for an hour, and I go, oh, I think that dude was racist.
Yeah.
Or he's just kind of like, it was like, it wasn't even about speeding. It was just, you're black. Like, to the point now, Bert, when I ride on the freeway, like, I love fitted hats. I don't wear them while I'm driving. If I get in a car, I take my hat off just so that on the off chance on the freeway, some cop is sitting in a speed trap and sees me speed by, maybe you won't profile me off the strength of the fucking hat. Just, you learn 18 years and half a million road miles. You start learning,
like,
little.
It's the fucking hat. Like,
yeah, this goddamn hat keeps getting me fucking pulled over. Or I went through a stretch for a while where I would wear a blazer when I drove in case I got pulled over, but the shit's too uncomfortable.
Yeah. You're like, oh, shit.
Officer, I'm on business.
As put your hands out of the car. I'm putting on my blazer, sir.
As you can see from this blazer, sir. Shit, man, I almost got locked up, but I was dead to rights on this one. I went to this chick's house. It was a booty call gone awry, and like two white cops roll up, and it's so backstory. So I'm doing a show in, I don't know, I think it was Toledo. It's not Toledo. What's south of Detroit? Is it Akron? No, that's Toledo.
It's Dayton. No, it's Toledo.
Yeah, it's Toledo.
South of Detroit. It's so funny, I just learned that the other day.
So, I'm supposed to go down to Cincinnati to fly out. And I was kind of, you know, fooling around with this chick in Columbus at the time. And she, you know, straight up booty call. I'll be real with what it was. Hey, come through. I'll be home around 2. It'd be nice to see you before your flight. Cool, no problem.
Yeah.
Hit the road. Get a text from her. She's drunk. And she sends me a picture of her, panties. Then she sends me a picture of the panties on the floor. Like, it's that subtle. Exactly. So I speed. Because you see the panties, then you see the panties on the floor. You're like, yeah.
Your foot gets heavy. You're like, oh, shit.
Dude, I pull up at this chick's house at like in 2:30 in the morning. And I call. And she doesn't answer. I knock on the door, and she doesn't answer. And it's fucking freezing. It's like fucking, I don't know, dude. It's like fucking 10 degrees or whatever. So I've got on a skull cap. I've got the mask joint. I don't even know if it's a condition. I don't know what it is, bro. But I got a condition where if my eyes are exposed to really, really cold air for extended periods of time, I get an irritated mucous membrane.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know if it's like a sty or what, but like basically I get watery eyes for like a week and a half because my eyes were too cold because it became inflamed.
Yeah.
So sometimes if I'm going to be outside for more than 5-10 minutes, I'll throw on goggles or shade, something to break the wind.
Yeah.
So I got goggles on. I got on a skull cap. I got the ski mask, like the front thing that covers your face.
You're just cold, but you also happen to be black.
I look like Special Ops. And I got the backpack. I got my laptop because I don't want to leave my laptop in the fucking hood in a rental car. Black jacket, the whole wop. And I'm knocking on this door, and this chick won't fucking open. She won't fucking open the door, bro. And so I hop the fence, and I figure, all right, maybe she left the back door open. Back door's closed. I hop back as I'm coming back over the fence. Freeze, motherfucker, and I bet you better not fucking move. And some fucking cops, and somebody's called in a suspicious persons report on me. And so they fucking cuff me on suspicion of burglary, and I'm in the back seat of the car, and they're going through my laptop bag and, you know, looking for burglary tools.
Yeah.
And like, is this your laptop? And I'm trying to explain to him, sir, I'm a comedian. If you look in my bag, you will see my MapQuest. This is back when fucking MapQuest, bro. This is like fucking, I'm printing my MapQuest directions because GPS wasn't quite the shit on the phones yet. Sir, as you can see, my MapQuest directions there. I am clearly headed to Cincinnati. And then and he wasn't hearing none of that shit. He goes, shut the fuck up. And like every time I try to say something, his reply is shut the fuck up. Like not even giving me opportunity to explain myself. And I don't know if that's some power move that cops do to assert whatever the fuck. But it's, you came over a fence. I know what this is. I have it figured out. I'm a cop. You shut up. I'm just checking this for drugs to decide what to charge you with or whatever. And the other cop is in the car. You got one car, one cop outside on the hood, putting all my shit on the hood. And the other cop is inside the car and he's taking out my information. And I go, yo, man, just look at my phone. Please, I'm telling you, I'm supposed to be here. Just look at my fucking phone. And the cop in the car looks at my phone and sees the panties and her address. And they fucking let me go. And it,
shut up.
They were like, clearly she's not in, whatever, she's not interested. Leave this place. That was his words. Leave this place.
Yeah.
Like on some, you shouldn't even be here. I don't know. It was the hood, but I mean, whatever it was on some, we almost fucked your world up.
Yeah.
But we didn't leave. And you know, I can't say that. I can't say those cops were racist, but I definitely, definitely feel like Penny saved my life. Like, she was fucking. Fast forward to the next day, she was shit-faced drunk and didn't hear me knocking. She was already passed out.
God.
But those cops, it's too white cop, like, they were not fucking with me, bro. They weren't trying, like, there was nothing to be reasoned with, nothing to discuss.
There's like a thing that happens in this, in the world that I think white people don't understand, which is, if you're black and cold and you bundle up, you look like you're breaking into houses.
Especially when you hop fences.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that I haven't had bad run-ins with black cops. I mean, I think it's more of a power thing with the bad cops that exist. I got two badges in my family. I've done ride-alongs with my cousin. You know, he works, I won't say where, but he's in Mississippi. And I got another one in Illinois. And they're good, upstanding black gentlemen who want to fight to fucking make the world a better place. It's weird when you're not sure how much your blackness is playing into a situation. So sometimes when you're in a weird place, the first instinct is to tone it down. Like, I don't rent cars with out of state plates. I don't rent cars with tags different from the state that I'm performing in.
Really?
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Is that because they...
I just don't want no reason for you to follow me, bro. I want you to see me and see almost a regular-ass car. If I'm in Nebraska, I want a Nebraska-plated car when I pull out the Enterprise lot.
Yeah.
Because I don't want no shit. Because I don't know.
I think probably the most racist thing I've ever done in my life consistently is not listen. And not pay attention.
Not listen to black women.
And not just pay attention to like shit like that. This, when I was turning, I think I was turning 40. This is 3 years ago. Almost 4 years ago. I was not drinking for a period of time. No reason at all. Just, I was home and I just wasn't drinking. And our friend called, who's black, and said, hey, what are you doing? It was like 10 o'clock at night. I said, nothing. I'm just getting ready to go to bed. And he goes, I need your help. Our dog got out, and I can't go looking for him. And this is right around the Trayvon Martin time.
I went,
what? And he goes, our dogs got out. The girls are losing their mind. They're falling apart. And I cannot go out in today's society with a flashlight walking around the neighborhood. People will think things. And he's like, I need you to either go with me or you to just do it by yourself. And I was like, dude, yeah. I was like, Holy shit. Yeah, you can, because I, by the way, I was walking around. We ended up going together. We ended up splitting up, like, but just going, like one direction, one was.
Yeah.
And I was going in the back of a house, calling for the dog, like, the driveway, looking in the driveway.
What time of night is this? How late?
10 o'clock, 10:30 at night.
Shit.
Woman comes out and sees me and says, "Is everything okay?" And I said, "My friend lost his dog. We're looking for his dog." She got out of her house and she started looking. Do you think that would have happened with him?
Fucking no. No
way. And that blew me away. And I remember getting back in bed with my wife. At like, we ended up finding the dog. The dog was in the house the whole time under a fucking bed.
Jeez.
And we end up finding the dog, coming home. And I remember just being blown away. Like, there's moments like that in my life where I've been blown away that I never really... I never looked at anyone else's story. Like, I'd say empathy is the wrong word. Like, I didn't have empathy for anyone, but I just never paid attention.
Yeah, but is that racist or is it just being oblivious? And I feel like that is where we are as a society now, where there's some white people who just don't know. They just didn't know. And then people go, "You racist motherfucker." It's like,
well, all the stuff you're talking about, like getting pulled over, about wearing a ball cap and having in-state plates and all this stuff. And then I think there's so many people. I mean, if you look at my Facebook wall, that it is so many people that it's like black people need to learn how to get pulled over. I was taught how to get pulled over by my father. You have your hands on, the interior light on. And I'm like, I bet if you got pulled over 10 times a month or whatever it is, I bet it would start getting old. I bet it would start getting like, you'd be like, "I get it. I'm doing all the right things." But
ask Steve Byrne next time you see him, ask him the story about us getting pulled over coming back from San Diego on a Sullivan and Son show. I was driving. We all rode together. We got pulled over, I don't know, somewhere on the 405. We're near Long Beach. We were damn near back to L.A.
Yeah.
As I'm pulling over, interior lights on, all four windows down. And Owen Benjamin's in the car. He goes, "Dude, what are you doing?" I just go, "Trust me." And my move when the cops come, I open my sunroof, right hand out the sunroof, chilling on the sunroof. Left hand on the side view mirror, because I want both of my hands in clear view of the camera that's on the dash.
Yeah.
Like, that's, it's just protocol. And the windows are already open so that there's no bullshit about what was the window, like the shit that's happening right now with the guy that got shot in Oklahoma City. Well, was he reaching in the car? Was he nah, man, y'all not gonna do that to me. It's, the window was clearly open. It's like, you have to think about stuff like that. And a lot of people, if you don't live like that, you don't have to think like that. Like, I have Indian friends, and they tell me stuff that they go through. And as a black man, I'm like, oh, damn, I didn't think that. Like, you're only concerned with your walk, because that's what's important to you every day. So yeah. It's cool that a lot of what's happening is happening now in the country, and it's opening people's minds a little bit more to what's going on. You know, that's the upside to, like, this new generation of.
What a great opportunity, though, for you to be in it. You're on the one show that has the one listenable voice to talk about social, to talk about what's going on in society. Like, how fucking badass is that?
Dude, I sit and I go back and forth with, like, making sure that I balance the stories that I do with, you know, stuff that matters as a whole. And then also looking at it from a perspective of, you know, as a black man, whether I want it or not, man, I got a responsibility to talk about a lot of this black stuff, because nobody else is going to tackle it like me. They're not going to hit it like me. They're not going to be able to bring the perspective to it that I can. And there's literally no other black correspondent on the show right now since Jessica Williams left. And until they replace her, it's on me. So
I think in the one thing that you have that a lot of people, like, the biggest problem in comedy right now, in my opinion, are people getting behind an agenda and forgetting that the reason they're on stage is to make people laugh. One of the things that you have that's fucking undeniable is just a natural sense of humor, where if you do take a subject like that and tackle it, you would tackle funny first, agenda second. Like,
yeah.
That is the one thing that I feel like with young comics these days, it's like
I'm right. Punchline.
Yeah.
It's the other way around, bro. It's punchline, 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 punchline. As you see from these punchlines, I am right.
That is, man.
That's what Carlin used to do. Carlin can make you laugh at stuff you didn't even agree with.
That's the point of comedy. There's so many times that I, like, and I guess you get jaded. We get jaded the longer we're in it. So you can say something completely outrageous, and I'm just sitting there going, what's this? Where's the, like, where's it going to be?
Yeah.
It, but, like, when I first got in here, and I'd hear, I remember Jim Norton told a joke, and he was like, something about a sniper. And he was like, there was a sniper, you know, and a lot of people want to talk bad about the sniper. I've been in his shoes. I bet his parents are proud of him or something like that. And I just was like, I was like, oh, what a different it was so neat to see that different perspective. And I haven't spent a ton of time, but the stuff I see online, I know that, and I'm not going to name names, but there's a lot of comics who just want to basically say, I'm a good person. I'm vegan. I'm pro LGBT. There's no joke in this at all, but I just want you to know I'm very good.
And those people are progressing and growing, and they have an audience, but I just feel like the first comic that does what they do with more punchlines,
yeah,
you are now irrelevant. And that's your fault because you had the bacon first, and you let them come and take it from you. So when you start prioritizing perspective over humor, You're in a losing battle because someone's going to come and out funny you, because at the end of the day, people just want to laugh.
It's like, you look at Patrice. Patrice is one of my favorites. His fucking, he'd say really aggressive shit, but back it up with a joke. I think you should be allowed to sexually harass women. And everyone's like,
you go, what? The fuck? And then he takes you on a 10-minute journey of justification, and
by the way, he really wanted to sexual harass women. Like,
yeah, there was,
I mean, that's agenda driven as any social justice warrior. Patrice was agenda driven,
and women, you could look in the crowd and see women laughing.
Yeah, because it was because he said, I'm not going to say this unless it's funny. This is how I feel. I'm going to figure out.
God, I wish I had the guts. I was with him in London, and it's me, Patrice, Arena Franklin, and a couple of local comics from London.
That's really funny.
And I don't know, this is my first time interacting with Patrice. I'm not going to front like he and I were best friends or some shit. Like, I knew him professionally. We see each other. Hey, yeah. Hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
He goes up in a room, some random Jamaican room in London. So it's like, not only is it Def Jam, but it's like Def Jam and foreign Def Jam.
Yeah.
And just does like 30 minutes off of the room and the people in the room. And it's real. It's opinions. Like, it was still comedy, but it was like,
yeah,
fresh baked. Like, I don't even know how to explain it, man. It was like watching somebody make a meal in front of you from scratch.
Fuck, just pulling together ingredients. I got a shoelace. I got a rock. And you're like, oh, this is a good soup.
Yeah. Like, it was a legit great master's class on how to just speak your mind. And then from those opinions, that's where all the humor comes from. But, you know, we live in an era where, you know, it's a lot of bloggers posing as comedians, and it's a lot of, you know, comics out there that I feel like if I took your set and put it on paper verbatim, it would be a great think piece. It would be a great written.
Be a good jumping off place.
Yeah. But it lacks some of the punchlines, but you know, I've learned, Bert, man, 18 years. I don't get mad or bitter or angry. Like, everybody's running their own race. So whatever you're doing, if you think that works for you, hey man, cool. I think you're going to have a problem professionally in about 5 years when the next you comes up and they can do what you're doing, but funnier, you're fucked.
Or they have a marketing plan behind them.
Or they're more original than you. Like, yeah. So if you're lacking any of those things, you're vulnerable to being taken over. Because of any of the comics that you can name, if we start talking gods, if we start talking guys that are legit selling tickets, doing well at a sustainable level of 5 to 10 years or longer, I'm not even in that discussion yet. But those guys that are, none of those comedians are similar. None of them have similar stylings. Yeah. None of them have similar takes on anything. So you can be similar now, but sooner or later you got to figure out how to be unique, motherfucker, or you're expendable and you will be gone. And I look at the droves of comics that, fuck man, you know, And it's frustrating because you see guys who you know are good and better than what they choose to do on stage.
Yeah.
You know, man, I can tell you stories about when we used to – BET's Comic View, man. We used to go and do we would watch Comic View tapings back in the – this is how janky BET was back in the day.
Janky.
Dude, niggas could show up to a Comic View taping and just get on – if someone that was taping just said, yeah, he's funny, make sure he gets on.
Really?
So you would go to New Orleans hoping to be chosen as, they call it an alternate slot. You want to be chosen as an alternate because so-and-so didn't show up or somebody bombed in the previous taping, so we need another comedian to make up for the bomb. So we went to the Orpheum Theater in New Orleans the year that Bruce was hosting. Comic View Party Gras. And you would sit in the lobby and you had like your two suits. You had your two wardrobe choices.
Yeah.
And you had them already dry cleaned and pressed. And you sat in the lobby all night, all day, hoping to be chosen as an alternate. And you would just sit and talk comedy with all of these different, and it was mostly black acts. It was predominantly black acts, but.
And was, Gary Owen.
Yeah, and Gary Owen. But Gary Owen was already booked. Yeah, right?
It was
probably, he ended up hosting the season.
Gary Owen, by the way, is one of the sweetest guys in the fucking
world. Oh, he's fucking awesome,
dude. One of the greatest guys.
Watch his reality show, Tuesday nights on BET. I think it's at 10:30 Eastern?
Yeah.
But I would see all these guys, and I just saw this obsession with working black rooms with so many black comics. So many black comics were just focusing on working black rooms. And so when I started, I was like, there's more rooms that it's not a, there's only so many black rooms, and black comedy is set up where there's really only one king of the hill at the time. There's a king of hill, there's the king of the hill and a couple of heir apparents.
Yeah.
And then there's everybody else. Like the Shaq Roast has kind of created another tier of prominent black comics who can go out and work. But we're all here to do Comic View to gun for one of the six positions that is available in black comedy right now. Even now, Kevin Hart's top of the heap. You got Mike Epps and Cat Williams when he feels like it. He comes down from the comedy mountain and does some shit. And then you probably have D-Ray, Corey Holcomb, Tony Rock, and a lot of other people that have done the Shaq Roast that are really
Melanie
capable.
Camacho,
there you go. You
Tiffany
see what
Haddish.
I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. It's
like
it's,
Haddish is next. Lil Rel is next. But Lil Rel is even more, I would put him more mainstream. And even Haddish, too. She's kind of crossed over a little more.
Yeah, I think she's crossed over.
So I was sitting there, and I'm like, I'm looking at all these comics, and I'm like, nobody's doing anything that's unique. And I'm not... I ain't no fucking comedy genius, man. But the only thing I ever tried to do was something different from what everybody else was doing, because I figured that would probably get me booked faster. So if I'm as funny as you, if we're both equally funny, but I'm talking about suicide and you talking about putting mayonnaise on the pussy, I'm going to get booked before you, because there aren't a lot of black comics talking about suicide.
And those showcase things, man, that really shines like just how much of your material is original or not. When I did The Last Comic Standing 2, 9 of us had I got pulled over by a cop joke. And I was like, fuck, man, I got pulled over. That's my opening act. That's my opening bit. And it was just, and you were like, wow, man, I'm not writing original. I'm writing just what everyone else is writing.
Yeah, you figure out ways to make it even more, or you just change... Just change the vessel in which you deliver it, because that joke isn't about getting pulled over. The joke is about an interaction you have with a cop. Why the fuck does it have to be in a car? Put it in a mall. Yeah. Put it in a fucking store. I saw a cop in a store. I didn't know he was like, and you proceed down the same joke path. So, man, I used to watch Comic View, man. I would fucking watch that shit, bro. And I would make a list. I watched 2 straight seasons of Comic View, and I just made a list of every topic that was touched on that night. And at the,
that's so smart.
And at the end of the season, I looked at the topics and I went, okay, no jokes about these topics. So no fat girls, no sex, no I'm so broke, no credit, no black people do this, white people do that. Like no raggedy car jokes, no fucking price of gas. Like I just made a list of shit. I'm not going to joke about this shit. I'm going to figure out a way to make these jokes funny, because if nothing else, when I go showcase for Comedy Central – at least I'm talking about something different. Even if I ain't as funny as you, fuck it, I'm talking about something different. And if you look at half the comics that do get chances now, they're more different. They're as different as they are hilarious. If you look at the – just go look at the gamut of – because I'm sure comics are listening to this shit. Look at the gamut of comics that have done Conan or James Corden in the last 5 years and tell me anything that's similar about any of them.
Yeah.
They're all different. And there ain't nothing like any of them anywhere else. So
the real example should be Rory Scovel. Rory Scovel is one of the most original.
Fuck, bro.
One of the most original. Everything he does is totally different than anything anyone's doing ever. That guy is one of the most original comics working.
I sat in the Orpheum, man. I say all of that to say this. I'm sitting in the Orpheum in Comic View waiting to hopefully be chosen as an alternate. I don't really know enough black comics at that time. You know, I wasn't in the loop, you know, but I'm just looking at all these guys and I'm just like, y'all don't get it. Like, you're writing to a, like, this is, if you continue down this path with this type of material, it's finite. We got to elevate. We got to do more. Nah, man, I'm going to do this joke and then this joke and that. And there's a place for all types of humor, but man, there's more money where I'm trying to go. You know, it's more opportunities. You know, it is a fucking log jam to get to the top of black comedy.
Of just comedy. But yeah. Black comedy has less opportunity. You're completely
right.
There's
fewer stages. There's no, they just brought back Def Jam again for the first time in 8 years. It's back on. And I guarantee you half of those slots were already gone before the announcement was made. Yeah. So if you're new, young, black, and funny, that's hard, man. That's a very specific skill set. And a lot of those guys that I saw back in those days, man, they're not working anymore, or they're barely working.
I worked with a guy that was so talented. His name was Damn Fool. I don't know if he's still doing it.
Uh-huh.
And I remember telling him, I was like, hey, man, like, you don't have to be Damn Fool. I remember saying that in the green room to him. And we were both younger. This is a long time ago. And I don't know if he still goes by Damn Fool, but I remember saying, you don't have to be Damn Fool, because that's really going to fucking handcuff you in getting into white rooms. Like, no white person will ever go buy a ticket to see Damn Fool, because you're just, as a white person, I'm saying, honestly, you go, I don't want to go to that show. That show's going to be chaos. They're going to pick me out. I'll be the one white person. Like, it just, it fucking limits your thing. And he was so funny that I was like, but he was, in his perspective.
Oh, he's crushing in LA. He's winning contests, all that stuff. And yeah. It's just, once you commit to that, it's like, okay, that's the road you want to go down? Hey, man, and fucking crush that shit.
I'm sure he could say the same thing to me. Why don't you have more flavor in your name? Why don't you fucking, why are you going by Bert Kreischer? Who the fuck wants to be Bert Kreischer? Why don't you just Bert? But I remember being like, and this was my white perspective. I was sharing it with him in the green room in fucking Michigan. We were at we were in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And I was like, dude, I go, what's your name? Like, just go by your name, because you're so funny. I was like, I kept saying, like, Dave Chappelle could have easily been a Damn Fool, but he chose Dave Chappelle, and we all know Dave Chappelle, and he can do exactly what you're doing. And it's the, like, in my head, I was like, I remember trying to change my name to just Bert at one point. I just wanted to be Bert, and it did not work. So they'd be like, ladies and gentlemen, your feature for this evening, Bert.
Just,
and it would
Bert.
Just be silent. No one would applaud, and they go, you're a headliner for the night. They were waiting for a last fucking name.
Yeah, Damn Fool is good. My thing is, like, when comics choose that path, hey, man, more power to you.
Fuck yeah.
And he's got the jokes to fucking do. Because there's
he's really talented.
There's
That's
guys that make it out of it. Like, there's Lil Duval, who's running rampant on MTV and MTV2. You got Charlamagne the God. You got Shawty on Wildin' Out. So, I mean, did you know Cat Williams' original name was the Cat in the Hat? He used to perform at Bitch. Go Google that shit.
The Cat in the Hat?
The Cat in the Hat. And he used to do, he would do Comic View, and he had this weird top hat on, and his persona was still pimping and still what he is now.
Yeah.
But he was the Cat in the Hat. I don't know when he changed it to Cat Williams, but
he's one of my favorite comics to ever watch. I love watching him.
Yeah. I just know that for me, I recognize that what I do comedically, I wasn't going to get to the top of that. And I just felt like the line was shorter over here. So, you know, there's a lot of guys that I felt like could do both. You could be black and do black rooms and not have to be a quote unquote black comic.
But yeah, but that's the other thing is that like there's.
I just wish more guys had figured that out, man, because there's so many good guys that are just left in the dust now.
So many. So many. I'm glad to hear Damn Fool's working, because he really was. He featured for me, and I had a hard time following him the entire week. And it was like, and it wasn't pandering bullshit. It was original material. And I was like, in my perspective, short-sighted, you know? It's like, I guess if you're going to work black rooms, you need a name that stands out. You can't.
Yeah, if you're going to work black, go black. Like, matter of fact, be Damn Fool, motherfucker. Like, add motherfucker to the, modify your Damn Fool. But yeah, Roy Wood
Cedric Jr. Cedric the Entertainer. You know, that's the Cedric the Entertainer. His newest special is fucking fantastic.
Yeah, the Netflix joint came out with a band.
With a band? Yeah. Fucking
who
shut
comes
the
on stage
fuck up
with a marching band.
Got me next special.
Dude, I'm trying to figure out what I want to do for you ever have a joke that starts from, let me ask you about your writing process. Because your style is so different.
Yeah.
It's extreme. Just like some of the corners you'll take. Like, do you start with the premise and then figure out how to make it funny? Or do you start with, oh, this is funny. Now, how do I make a point to this? How do I add, how do I birdify thought or observation?
Most of it is I'll have one funny thing in it. There'll be one funny thing. So, like the story with Ralph Sampson. There was one funny part in it, the whole point was, and this has happened to me a couple times, is the short story in short is Ralph Sampson comes to our basketball camp, and he's trying to give a speech about discipline, and it's predominantly black kids, and and he says, "Who in here parties?" And I thought we were all going to raise our hands. And I was the only one to raise my hand. That moment is real for me because I remember that moment. I remember being like, fuck, I didn't need to raise my hand. And there's like three other times in my life where I've raised my hand and I didn't need to raise my hand. And I was like, and I've recognized that. So I was like, that's the jumping off part. And then there were three parts after that that worked really well, in my opinion. And so I was like, okay, so I got these three. Now I need a way to get into it. And my big thing that I struggle with I need an end to this story. And so if I just tell it enough, I'll find things. Like I went ziplining with my daughters. This is a new bit I'm working on. And Isla, this is the only funny part to me was that Isla, my youngest, who's a little fucking out there, she was not paying attention at all. And she clipped in to go ziplining. She clipped into the middle of a Vietnamese family. And I just was like, it's this great moment. You go, what the fuck are you doing? And in that process, I had gone spelunking with my wife. And I had this like this feeling that I connected with as a child, where I was like, where you get embarrassed of your team. Like I remember being with my parents and being like, I'm cooler than these people. Like, and people would look at me and I go, this isn't representative of me. I'm better than them. And I had that same feeling with my family. And I was like, I'm on TV. These guys are like, I'm better than this. Like they don't like. And so
treated like an adopted white kid with a Vietnamese family.
And so then I'll take that one thing and I'll work it from there. And it just is, you know, I credit this to Rogan. I was a very lazy comic before I did Rogan's podcast. And then when I did Rogan's podcast, my storytelling, which I was always better at than joke writing, was kind of profiled. And Rogan was like, you got to write that machine story. And that machine story, the 12-minute story, was a fucking PhD class in learning how to tell a story and learning what was important and what wasn't important. And from that, I've learned how to tell stories better and better and better. And then you get a story where like, I got a story now that I'm telling that is not funny. But it kills. It doesn't kill, but it does well.
Yeah.
But it's not funny. The premise, if I wrote it on paper, you'd be like, I don't. But if I told it to you, you'd go, I've been there. Like it's finding this connective tissue for me of something like, and then working it backwards and just filling it up. You know.
See, I can't do that. I can't write stories, and I'm not a storyteller in the least. My thing is find. All right. What are the two sides to the issue? And then where's the third side to this issue?
Yeah.
Or why do both sides not matter on this issue? So if it's something I'm at, like, it's more disbelief than anger is what I try to play on stage. Sometimes it comes across as anger, but like I'm working a bit now about the national anthem and how, like, I don't even want to get into whether or not you should or shouldn't take a knee. That's a separate discussion. The people I'm upset with are the people who are surprised that black people have a problem with America. Like, and so then the whole bit, the national anthem shit is just an entry point. But for me, it's just attacking people who are so blind that they're shocked.
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing to be, oh, I didn't know that was happening, but to be shocked, like, that, if you're shocked, that means you thought we were having a great time. And now you're taken aback.
Yeah.
That we're not patriotic. And it's a long bit, but the whole premise of the bit is just about how black people, you can't expect patriotism out of black people. It's never been who we are. Listen to our music. Nowhere in the history of black music is there a hit patriotic song.
No.
We don't do patriotism.
Not even the Fat Boys did one.
No.
If you're gonna, like, if someone was gonna give you one, it would be the Fat Boys.
We'll do a cover, but we won't write original patriotic shit. That's just not black. That's white artists write original patriotic song. Yeah, and so then I go down
the,
exactly. So then the joke is going down the line.
That's great.
And then you talk about how black people don't talk about America. Black people sing about specific cities where they can have a good time. And so then you break down all the songs where black people talk about cities. So you got Welcome to Miami, California Knows How to Party, Georgia On My Mind, Empire State of Mind with Jay-Z. Like, so
God,
you start.
Yeah.
So it's like about just the dichotomy, the black psyche, and how black music tells you what we're feeling. And that's really what the joke is about. So it, to me, it's like finding this third prism to what's apparently a two-sided issue. And so that's kind of how I try to write. You know, sometimes there's issues where, all right, the Confederate flag, yeah, I'm against the flag, but let's also acknowledge that it was kind of helpful.
That's what I like of what you do is you take the point and then you look at both, you look at all angles of it and then come from the one where everyone's like, oh, I thought he was going to go that way.
That's what I try. And that's where The Daily Show has really helped my writing, bro. My God, dude. You sit in a room every morning with like fucking 10 or 11 Emmy winners. Because there's a lot of the old guard that's still there on the writing staff from Jon Stewart's days. And you'll walk in the room. The way I describe it is that I'll walk in the room with an apple and I want them to help me slice it. And these motherfuckers will take the apple and slice, bake it, sprinkle cinnamon on that shit, fucking toast it, flambe, add some granola, some crumbles, pie crust.
You walk out of the room confused with a strudel.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. I just want you to help me slice this apple. Yeah. These motherfuckers have made the most delicious, amazing apple tart dish with the same apple.
And it's in the wheelhouse of what you do. You're basically writing, I mean, theoretically, like 3-minute bits or like, it's like
100%.
It's what your strength is. It's taking that and showing, just seeing the way other people do it.
I can't tell you how many times there's been bits that I've done on the show where I'm just like, God damn, I wish I could do this on stage.
Yeah.
God damn. But the ethics in me won't let me take something that we've already done on the show and put it, going back to the whole writing, who's writing the bit type thing. But yeah, God damn. One of the writers wrote something one day about black people and ghosts and how being black is exhausting. It's an exhausting existence. That's why there's no black ghosts, because black people are so tired they don't have the strength to come back from the dead. They just want to rest. I'm not doing it justice, but like, it's definitely like, it's just one of those days like, God damn, I wish I'd have thought of that. And I have those moments every day, man. So it's a blessing, dude.
Dude, I'm so happy for you. I really am. You were living in the same building as my sisters for a while.
Dude, Beechwood. Long live Beechwood. That is a weird building. They still packages there.
Yeah.
I'm still in the Facebook group for that building. It's just a bunch of old white people arguing about the swimming pool.
Oh, well, the swimming pool's back.
Yeah. Oh, it's back now. Is the warmer on again? It's getting colder. Is the swimming pool heated this year?
We went to go have dinner at my sister's the other day.
The pool is always there. It's going. It's there.
And there was this white man sitting in the lobby, and me and my daughters walk up to the front door. Our arms are filled. Like, we're bringing fucking food over.
Yeah.
And he's sitting in the lobby, and we just went, hey, can you open the door? And he just went, no. And I went, I'm here with two little girls. I'm not breaking in. So I was like, fuck. So I put my stuff down. I hit the code. Door opens. I walk in, and I'm just looking at him. We're both waiting for the elevator. I go,
yeah.
Couldn't have just gone. But that's that mentality. That is that weird.
That's Beachwood.
Yeah.
They're very, very weird over there. But, man, I appreciate it, Senna.
Dude, I'm fucking so excited for you, man. It's fun to watch a friend fucking blow the fuck up.
Well, I appreciate it, sir. So I'll try and keep delivering, and then maybe one day I can finally headline in Nebraska.
We'll be fucking 50. Club. We'll be doing a tour of 50.
You know what I want to do, man? Just to be a dick. It'll be petty, and I'll look like the asshole, so I can't do it, but I want to do it. I want to do an across-the-street tour. And I just want to do comedy at venues that are physically across the street from clubs that never headlined me.
Oh, that's a fucking...
And right now, I know for sure it would be Looney Bin, Wichita. Looney Bin, Little Rock. And the Funny Bone in Greensboro. No, the Comedy Zone in Greensboro, North Carolina.
God, they never headlined me either.
Those would be... It's so petty. I'll go back and headline these rooms and just make money. Like, now I get why comics have the weird riders in certain clubs. It's not because they're a jerk. It's because this club 10 years ago did something to you that you never forgot and you never got over because you're not an adult.
Yeah.
And then you just go, you know what? I want 3 plates of ribs in my green room.
I want white Air Force Ones, brand new.
Oh, I already know who you're talking about. Size eights. Funny thing about that guy with that rider is that he was headlining in Birmingham one year, and the comedy club, because he gets a new pair per show.
Per show, yeah.
So they
have to get 6 fucking Air Force size 8 Air Force
Ones. So they add 2 shows. He sells out. They add 2 shows. But they don't know where to go to get the sneakers because all of the white stores are sold out of size 8.
Yeah.
So they call me asking me, where are the black sneaker stores in town? And can you pick up 2 pair?
And do a guest set?
Because it was too close to show. And they need the sneakers have to be. There wasn't enough time for them to drive and drive back. But if somebody was already on that side of town, they could scoop them and bring them.
Oh, that's...
Dude, I had to go to, like, the fucking black mall and buy 2 pairs of Air Force Ones, size 8s, or else that dude wasn't going to go on stage.
I want to put that in my next rider. If I fucking blow up, I'm going to make... I want something like that.
To his credit, he donates them to inner-city children, but you got to figure at this point, he's been doing this. So that's what they say.
Yeah.
But at this point, motherfucker, you've been getting free sneakers for 5 years. How many size 8 fucking black kids are you meeting? There's got to be a size 7 or size 9. Like,
yeah.
Can you at least trade a man for store credit so the kid could go get something in his size?
Ooh, like, that's what I want. I want a size 8 hat of whatever your local team is fitted because I have a big fucking head. I would love that.
I'm a size 8 guy.
Are you really?
Yeah. Sometimes I can go 7 3/4, but I sweat and they shrink, so I need the 8.
It got to be 8 because it molds perfectly to my head.
Yeah, that's a good move. I don't know what my rider would
be. I'd be cool with a knife. Like, if they gave me a new knife every show.
That's creepy,
bro. I like knives.
The only thing I ask for in my riders at college shows, I ask for a soda, preferably a Dr. Pepper, and a stool. Only because more often than not with colleges, I'm usually coming there straight from the hotel or straight from the airport. And it's usually – sometimes I'm in a rush.
Yeah.
And you get to the venue, and it's a venue that doesn't have a soda machine.
Yeah.
And I need that sugar rush for colleges now. Like, I'm at that point in my career where I can't conjure up all of the youthful
energy.
Are you still doing
colleges?
Yeah, here and there.
I bet you're fucking murdering colleges.
They're fun, but I have to change up some of the material because, you know, these youngins, they're a lot more politically correct. You ain't getting up there talking about national anthem protests. You ain't juggling that dynamite. You know it's bad at colleges when Jerry Seinfeld says this shit's getting out of hand.
Yeah.
It's too politically correct.
God.
Yeah, man.
Well, hey, I appreciate you doing this, man.
Appreciate it, sir.
Congrats.
Thank you, sir.
Fuck yeah.
Good times.
This episode was brought to you by The Machine.